Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. Alright, I feel alright tonight. And I'll bring you precious contraband and ancient
tales. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We are here until 5 a.m. Hope everybody has stayed cool over the weekend. We're back. It's Monday morning. And that means my dad's going to tell a joke. Because it's a jokey time. We get a joke every Monday morning. And also, Steve and Eric are going to join me for the movie reviews, the Monday morning movie reviews, coming up in just a few minutes. Eric will stick around, and we'll talk about the box office for the weekend. Also coming up, we have some fun topics here. We have some pretty crazy origin stories for 30 everyday products. We're going to get into that. We've got some hidden treasures that are actually worth nothing. And lots of TV shows have made some continuity or weird errors that we can spot. And we've got a bunch of those we're going to talk about as we roll along this morning. You can call us at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. And Facebook is a great way to stay connected with us on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/Nick D Show. And also subscribe to our podcast. Every single second of every single show is a podcast. And we have a lot of people who subscribe to our podcast. And we thank you for that. And you can always do it. Go to your iTunes or go to any place where you can get your podcast. Search Nick D Show. Subscribe. It's free and will automatically be sent to your device. And you can listen at your leisure, bro. So that's what's coming up on this Monday morning. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Let me say hello to my great producer, Tom Hush. Tom, how are you?
I'm great, Nick. How are you?
I'm okay. Survived the heat over this weekend?
Yes. Thank God for central air.
Yeah. I only have a window unit in my bedroom, so I ended up crashing at my folks' house over the weekend. So I spent a bunch of time with my parents, which was actually a lot of fun, man. We watched Svengoolie together.
Oh,
and,
that's nice.
Yeah, it was really cool.
I like that.
It was one of the weirdest movies ever. My dad was like, what the hell is this? It's Village of the Giants.
Yeah.
Burt I. Gordon's ridiculous movie. And so we watched that, and we hung out and watched the Cubs, and it was fun. It was fun to hang out with my folks during the weekend, over this heated weekend. So there you go. All right, let's get into the newsroom. It's Vic Vaughn is back. Vic, how are you?
Oh, doing much better.
Good.
And happy to be back.
I'm glad you're back, too, man. We missed you. And
yeah.
Did you have a good weekend?
Yeah, I started to get on the mend actually late Saturday, so I actually was able to enjoy Sunday a little bit.
Okay.
So much better, though.
And the heat broke on Sunday, which was nice.
Yeah.
Because it was Friday and Saturday were ridiculous.
You know, and being out of the loop, being homesick, I just didn't really know that it was supposed to get so much cooler.
Yeah.
You know, it just dropped. I took the dog out and was like, what's happening?
Yeah. It became beautiful yesterday.
Yeah.
So, all right, I'm glad you're back, Vic. I'm glad you're feeling well.
Thanks, Nick.
And everybody's here. Tom's here. Vic's here. We're all here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. And my main man, the great Steve Cochran, comes up at 6 for your morning drive. All right, we're going to take a break here. And when we come back, Steve Procopi, Eric Childress will join me, and we will review all the new movies. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning, and that means my dad is going to call and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. And we are going to also talk about some of the origins of some everyday products, some really insane origins of everyday products that we see all the time. Also, there's a bunch of really fun mistakes that TV shows have made over the years, and we'll jump into that. And some hidden treasures that are actually worth nothing. So that's all coming up on the show. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can also check us out on Twitter, at Nick D Show, Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected here. All right, every Monday morning we review the new movies with Eric Childress and Steve Procopi. So then Eric and I talk box office as well. Let's get the guys in to get this Monday morning movie reviews going. And here is Eric. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, and Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, let's get started here. Did anybody see Into the Ashes?
No.
No.
Oh, okay, well, I'll get to that later. Steve, tell us about Sword of Trust.
Yes. This is a the new film by director and co-writer Lynn Shelton. It's about a guy named Mel, who is played by Marc Maron, who is a curmudgeonly pawn shop owner in Alabama, who spends most of his time sort of swindling his customers while trying and failing to get his sort of man-child employee, Nathaniel, who's played by John Bass, to do any work. A lesbian couple comes into the store, played by Jillian Bell and Michaela Watkins, and they are trying to sell what they are saying is a Civil War-era sword that Cynthia, who is Jillian Bell, recently inherited from her grandfather. And along with this sword comes documentation that alleges that this sword is proof that the South won the Civil War. And the weird thing is that they're probably like half your audience right now is probably thinking, oh yeah, I've heard about that. No, you did not hear about that. It didn't happen. And that's sort of the point of this film, is that it plays with expectations, it plays with the truth, it plays with conspiracy theories, and when word gets out about this sword into the sort of truther stratosphere, even though the stories are ridiculous, it isn't long before this so-called prover item draws the attention of some conspiracy theorists, as I mentioned, and then these four sort of hapless partners have to join forces in order to sell this sword to local fanatics who believe in it and say it's real, and they're willing to pay a lot of money for this. As with a lot of Lynn Shelton's films, a lot of the dialogue is improvised off like a loose outline of a story, but the story, like I said, the story is very much a comment on the fluid nature of truth today, and it's also a very funny film. It's maybe not one of Lynn Shelton's funniest or best, but I think Marc Maron is actually really terrific in it, and it's his first leading role in a movie at least, and the two women are very good in it as well. I mean, they're good at just about anything. It can be a little scary at times. There's a truck drive where the four of them are in the back of a truck, and they don't know exactly where they're going to a secret location where they're going to go sell this thing, and they're not exactly sure what's going to happen. But there's a sort of loopy and funny, and it maybe it meanders a little bit, but overall I give it points for at least an original story, which was created or co-written by a guy named Mike O'Brien, who, Nick, you probably know.
Oh, sure.
He used to be on SNL.
AP Bio.
He created AP Bio, yeah. Which just got a reprieve from death.
Yep.
He also has a really funny part in Booksmart.
Yes, he does.
But anyway, you know, it's original and has a really engaging cast, and I liked it. It opens at the Music Box.
All right, it's at the Music Box.
Yeah.
And how did it go with Marc Maron there?
He was great. He did two Q&As. Joe Swanberg, who produced the movie, moderated. He was terrific. And one of the shows was completely sold out, and he seemed to have a great time. And he watched most of the first screening with the audience sort of secretly and was, like, genuinely, I think, energized by their response to it. So,
that's nice.
Yeah, no, it was terrific.
And Lynn Shelton has directed several episodes of GLOW.
Glow. She did a lot of episodes in the final season of Marin, his show that was on IFC,
right,
and
right.
She's done a ton of TV.
She directed Love as well. She directed a bunch of episodes of Love too. And
yep.
and I like her. I like her movies. I want to get out and see this. And I love Mark Maron. It was it was I didn't go out very often this weekend because it was 100 degrees outside.
Yes.
All right, Eric. What did you think, man?
Yeah, I liked it too. I think there's kind of a perfect kind of cross section of a lot of different types of themes and things that we've seen in a number of movies that have come out of the independent circuit recently, a lot of the festivals that we've gone to. Describing Mark Maron as playing a curmudgeonly character is almost
really
kind of goes with the territory.
It's not out of his wheelhouse,
but he's actually probably less curmudgeonly in this movie than he is, and certainly in Glow and his television show. And I think part of that is that his character is actually not just this sort of this foil for all this ridiculousness that's going on. We know how great Mark Maron can be in just sort of just silent reaction to sort of idiots circling his space. But there's kind of a little bit of a dark undercurrent here, not just with the idea of where we are in this country and where things are going as far as these truthers and things like that are concerned, but also as his written into his character as a former addict. And these sort of monologues and there's this early scene in the movie where his ex-wife comes into the store and they have this sort of confrontation, and it's just the way that the two of them kind of react to each other is really kind of just subtly and beautifully done. And then this monologue that he has in this truck scene that Steve referenced is another terrific moment. There's some really funny stuff in this movie, especially when they get to the moment where they do have to sell the sword. I think the third act goes on a little bit too long, and then it just kind of cuts off and ends pretty quickly. But there's a lot to like in this movie. And it's just further evidence not only that Michaela Watkins and Jillian Bell are actually going to be in a movie coming out later this summer called Brittany Runs a Marathon that I highly recommend from Sundance this year.
Yeah.
So the two of them are really funny in this movie as well. But just Mark Maron is just a guy he's just one of these guys that you just want to see more of and get an opportunity to do more roles like this because I think he's terrific.
Yeah, he's great, man. He's just great. And it's nice to see Michaela Watkins actually carve out this niche that she has in movies now, because she got screwed over on SNL. She was only on SNL for one season, and it's funny that there are three women who went through SNL without really breaking any new ground, and Michaela Watkins is one of them. Noelle Wells was on for like a season and has proven to be really great, and then why am I blanking on the third
one? Jenny Slate
who on her first episode dropped an F-bomb.
Yep.
On her first episode of SNL, which I think sealed her fate. So these three women, extraordinarily talented, didn't get to be showcased on very well on SNL, and I'm glad to see where their careers have all gone. So that's cool. So Sword of Trust playing at the Music Box. You should check it out. All right, I'll tell you about Into the Ashes. This is on your on-demand system if you choose to watch it. It's your basic revenge movie. Luke Grimes, from True Blood and a bunch of other stuff, plays this guy who has a violent past, and he's trying to get away from it. But his old crew, led by Frank Grillo, everybody, decides that they want to seek revenge on him, or they want him to get back into it, and they kidnap his wife. So they take his wife, and he's confronted by a sheriff in the town, and he either has to completely forget about his past or do what they tell him to do in order to get his wife back. So it's your basic revenge thing, dark, violent past. I want to forget it, but they won't. They keep, every time I get out, they drag me back in, is basically the kind of thing here. It's directed by Aaron Harvey, who is a master of straight-to-VOD movies. He's directed like 15 straight-to-VOD movies, lots of them with Bruce Willis. This is a straight-to-VOD movie, everybody goes through the motions. It is one of those things where while they were making it, they were like, okay, let's just do a straight-to-VOD thriller, and it'll be what everybody expects it is. And it covers absolutely no new ground. Everybody seems to be sleepwalking through it. The action sequences have very little energy to them. You don't really care about the characters. This is basically absolutely as by the numbers in ABC as it gets. When you look on your video on demand and you see the title Into Ashes with Frank Grillo and Luke Grimes, I think you know what you're going to get already, and that's exactly what you get. So I do not recommend Into the Ashes. All right, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we've got more movies to review right here on 720 WGN. Eric, hang on. Steve, hang on.
Yes, thanks.
All right, there you go. Eric Childress, Steve Procopi. We'll take a break. We'll come back after the news, and we got more movies to review. And then Eric and I are going to talk about the box office right here on 720 WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. We're going to talk about the crazy origin stories of 30 everyday products. We've got some fantastic, ridiculous TV mistakes from the past, lots of them, like continuity errors and mistakes, and lots of fun picking apart some of the TV shows' mistakes from the past, and 12 hidden treasures that are actually worth nothing. That's all on your Monday morning show. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 for your Monday morning drive. Monday morning also means it's the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress, Steve Procopi join me every Monday to talk about the new movies, and then Eric and I will talk about box office and his box office report that he writes about every week. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay, again, I didn't get to see this one. I really want to. It was 100 degrees. I basically stayed in for most of the weekend. Eric, tell us about The Art of Self-Defense. I'm really excited about this movie.
Okay, well, this is a new film from writer-director Riley Stearns, who did a really overlooked film from a few years ago called Faults with Mary Elizabeth Winstead. People should find that one if they can't, about the cult leaders and deprogramming cult members. But The Art of Self-Defense is a little more lighthearted in its inception. Jesse Eisenberg plays kind of a mild-mannered accountant. Is there any other kind? One night he is going to buy dog food. He walks to the store, and as he's walking back, he is brutally attacked by a group of people on motorcycles. Having realized that there's little he can do to defend himself, he starts looking into alternative ways to prevent that from ever happening again, including buying a gun. But then coming across kind of a local dojo run by Alessandro Nivola, who goes only in the movie as Sensei, he joins the class and hopes to take, learn self-defense techniques that will help him if this ever comes up. But Sensei is not just a guru with the fists and whatnot. He has a certain type of philosophy that certainly bleeds into Eisenberg's character's ego, if you will. And he develops a different type of personality. It's a movie that begins to sort of give you the idea of what can happen when the wrong type of people start invading your brain and start, kind of turn the idea of ego and toxic masculinity into something that becomes potentially uncontrollable. All the time sort of masked in the way of a Jared Hess movie, if you will, but with the sensibility of a Jody Hill film. So this film actually goes quite dark at times. There's actually many comparisons you can make this to Fight Club, certainly. But you know, Eisenberg, you know, kind of excels at characters like this. There's a lot of fast dialogue in the film. He's kind of almost playing, kind of almost like an automaton with this character much of the time in his line readings. And it's a movie that it can hit you in the right way or can hit you in the wrong way. Like, you know, when I say Jared Hess, that's immediately going to turn off a lot of people. But like I said, there's a dark underbelly to this film, and it leads up to a climax that I've seen a couple times now, and I still can't believe that they pulled off. It is just one of the most hilarious climaxes to a movie you're going to see this year. But, you know, it actually sort of breeds, you know, sort of a really greater hate truth that's happening in our society today. And it's a movie that you're going to walk away with not exactly feeling great about where sort of this culture might be going, particularly with young white males who are looking to sort of make a name for themselves and to sort of boost their profile and to basically not take it anymore. We're seeing way too much of that in social media these days and in other sort of say political factions. But this is a really it's a challenging movie while being a really funny movie and a dark movie at the same time. Its influences are definitely being worn on its sleeve, but it ultimately it won me over. So I'm recommending Art of Self-Defense.
Okay. All right. What about you, Steve?
Yeah, no, I actually caught up with this at our the Critics Festival. I think it's great, and I think it's kind of funny that Riley Stearns has made two movies now about the dangers of groupthink. And this idea that you get sucked into something like this, and in this case, Jesse Eisenberg's character does it for a number of reasons. Part is that he gets a certain degree of self-worth and confidence, but he also likes that sense of belonging and accomplishment. There's like a ranking system in this thing that he seems to really care about. It's a really sharply observed satire about tribalism, and I think Eric called it toxic masculinity, which it definitely is, but it's almost like hyper masculinity, like these guys that just, that's their whole identity is wrapped up in how much of a man they can be and in how dumb that makes them look in the end. And Eric's not wrong about Eisenberg either. I actually think this is something very different for him. Usually he's playing something very neurotic and high energy, and this guy, whose name is Casey, he's like almost on the spectrum. He's got like a monotone delivery, very deliberate body movement, takes things a little too literally a lot of the times, and is very easily dissuaded from if something doesn't work out in his direction. And we see a lot of that at him at his job and how his attitude towards the people around him change as he gets more and more confident in his karate skills. So, and yeah, that climax, it's the climax, it's the exact climax you want, and you never would guess it would actually happen. It's phenomenal. The movie's worth it just for that. But I think the whole movie is good. And we didn't really talk about Imogen Poots is in this as one of the higher-ranking members of this dojo. And I think maybe the only female, I think, in the group. Is that right? The only one who's sort of in that secret society, yeah. And her frustration with being a part of this and her sort of having to deprogram a lot of her femininity in order to fit in. This film has a lot to say about that, too. I think this is a terrific film.
All right. The Art of Self-Defense is out right now. You should check that out. I'm definitely going to catch up with it at some point. Okay. All right, Steve. This is an aptly time for this movie to be released. Tell us about Armstrong.
Oh, certainly. Yes. Happy anniversary, everybody.
50th anniversary. 50th anniversary of the Apollo. On my Facebook page, I posted the front page of the Onion from that.
Yes.
one of the most genius Onion front pages of all time.
Oh yeah.
So all right, tell us about Armstrong.
So sometimes this is a documentary. Sometimes with documentaries, you just kind of have to let the story unfold and not worry too much about the bells and whistles that you can in some documentaries you can put in there, because Neil Armstrong's life is its own set of bells and whistles. You don't have to add anything to it. Obviously, a sizable portion of this movie covers the training and the carrying out of the Apollo 11 mission to the moon, during which Armstrong became the first human being to set foot on the moon. And I think he said something memorable. I don't remember what it was, though. I mean, thanks to this, like, an abundance of never-before-seen footage of both his personal life and his journey to space, the film takes a really great time looking at his life before and after that historic mission. I think that's some of the strongest stuff, actually. And some of the footage I think they're saying is never before seen is actually in the movie Apollo 11. So, but I think they probably had a race to get this out.
Yeah,
And anyway, but there's a lot of interviews here with his first wife, Janet, who was portrayed in First Man. His two sons, other family members, fellow astronauts, and other people he worked with at NASA. It's very clear this documentary is produced with the full cooperation and approval of those closest to him, which gives us a lot of insight into him. It also a little bit might smooth over some of the rougher parts of his life. He was often categorized as a recluse, when in fact I think he just got really overwhelmed with the media coverage and overall attention he received after the moonwalk. And then a lot of, most importantly, I think, a lot of, I assume it's an autobiography, it's clips from, there's readings from his autobiography done by Harrison Ford, which adds a great deal of gravitas to the story, and which goes from his childhood in Ohio to all the Gemini and Apollo missions that he was a part of, and he eventually faded back into life in Ohio and then lived out the rest of his days with a second wife and a fairly protective grip on his legacy. I think there's a really funny line in here that somebody says, or maybe it's one of his kids says, thank God social media didn't exist at this time, or he never would have survived the attention and scrutiny, especially when he stepped away from the public eye. So okay. I think Armstrong...
Steve, hang on.
Sure.
All right, we got that, and we want to find out what Steve and Eric thought of Armstrong, which is the biography, the documentary about Neil Armstrong. So we'll find out about that. We'll talk about more movies. We've got more movies to review, and we'll talk about the box office as well. That's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. We'll get back to it after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we are going to talk about the origins, some crazy origins of some everyday products that we all know about, and some TV continuity and ridiculous sort of TV mistakes exposed, so we'll do that a little bit. Right now, though, we're reviewing the new movies, and we will eventually talk about box office too. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me, and let's get back to it. Before the break, Steve was telling us about the documentary Armstrong. Let's get back to that. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, let's continue. Steve, Armstrong.
The only thing I was going to lastly say is just like the portrait this film draws up is a genuinely nice guy who just wanted to complete a job that was given to him, whether it was landed him in the history books or not. And it's a worthy biography and as good a way as I can think of to celebrate and mark the anniversary. So, and it's playing at Facets.
Facets. Yeah. By the way, I do want to mention, I haven't mentioned this on the air.
Right.
The founder of Facets, Miloš Stehek, passed away. And his contribution to the world of film in Chicago is kind of immeasurable. Facets is an amazing place, and during the height of VHS and video rentals, there was not a better place on the planet to get films than at Facets Cinematheque. Well, Facets Multimedia. located Fullerton near Ashland. And I just wanted to mention, Milos was an amazing guy. And what he did for this city in terms of cinema is incredible. And I just wanted to mention that. So it's playing at Facets. Mm-hmm. All right, Eric, what'd you think?
Yeah, I liked it too. And I certainly don't envy this film having to be, you know, sort of piggyback after we've had First Man and Apollo 11 come out, you know, over the last, you know, 9 months, basically. And so I was sort of worried going in that, you know, this is just going to be kind of treading the same water, things that we, you know, learned a little bit in First Man, footage that we've seen in Apollo 11, and, you know, but, you know, a topic in a period of history that I am, you know, borderline obsessed with.
Yeah.
So I had a lot about this particular period, so I didn't know, you know, how much more I was going to learn about Neil Armstrong. But you know, the fact that, like Steve said, that this movie certainly does have the full cooperation of the family, that it has access to a lot of personal stuff, a lot of personal home movies, stuff, you know, some stuff that we, you know, some NASA stuff certainly, but intimate moments with his family. You know, this movie goes into a little bit more about his young daughter, who you know, passed away at a very young age, and that sort of works as kind of an added addendum to First Man and the arc of that movie. So it was really nice to see that. My favorite stuff in the movie is actually the sort of like the first 50 minutes, as we get to know a little bit more, sort of the prelude to everything that's coming up to the Apollo 11 mission. There's a really great sequence in the movie that, which is not an Apollo 11, obviously, but details the Gemini 8 mission that is, it's detailed in First Man. It's the mission where they ended up in this really horrible role,
yeah,
that they had to get out of. And there's actual footage of that in this documentary that is really the most riveting sequence in the movie. You know, once you get to the Apollo 11 stuff, there's, again, if you've seen Apollo 11, which I think is one of the best movies of the year, you've seen a lot of that stuff. You've sort of been through that a bit, so you're not going to get a lot of new information there. Then you get a little bit more of just at least one certain guy really did not like Buzz Aldrin, which is, again, brought up in First Man quite a bit.
Yeah.
But you get a little bit of a little sense of that, and the guy that actually, you know, probably made sure that Neil Armstrong was the first guy to actually set up on the moon because he didn't like Buzz Aldrin that much.
Right. Right.
Yeah, so stuff like the little tidbits like that are really interesting. You know, the idea that he just kind of was so overwhelmed, just kind of walked away from everything once he got back. You know, there's something poignant to that. It seemed like he really did fulfill his own personal mission, which is something, again, people who have not seen First Man really need to go back and see that movie. But again, on this momentous anniversary that we've been living through this entire week, basically, you know, to go see Armstrong and see any of this footage on any kind of giant screen possible, I'd recommend people getting over to Facets and checking this out.
Yeah, it's at Facets right now. By the way, First Man was on HBO, debuted on HBO this weekend. No one saw that movie in the theater, and it was great. It's a great movie, and it's unfortunate that people don't have the opportunity to see it in IMAX, which is the way to see it. But if you got HBO, really a ridiculously underseen and underappreciated movie. Just First Man is fantastic, and also and Armstrong. And you're right, Apollo 11, that documentary is amazing too. Lots of great stuff. There's a Nat Geo documentary that our friend Rod Pyle was a part of. Lots of really great ways to celebrate this 50th anniversary. And so Armstrong playing at Facets right now. Okay. All right. I didn't see The Lion King, and I don't care. It was, again, I will preface this by saying it was 100 degrees out, but I don't even know if it was 65 out. I don't know if I would want to see The Lion King. But Eric, tell us about The Lion King.
Okay. Well, the plot is the exact same thing as you saw in 1994. The animated film that became a phenomenon and has remained a phenomenon for the past 25 years. This is Jon Favreau, as he did in some respects with The Jungle Book a few years ago, basically redoing the movie in a photorealistic way, and so all the animals and all the creations, they're not animated, but they are completely CGI'd into the frame. So, you know, people know the story of the Lion King. Simba is born, and his father, Mufasa, is king. His brother is Scar, who very much wants to have the throne, but, Mufasa and Simba stand in his way. So he concocts a plot and a conspiracy that ends up murdering the king and outcasting, shaming and outcasting Simba into the wild, where he befriends Timon and Pumbaa and learns to, reinvents himself. When it's discovered he is still alive, comes back to regain the throne, and people know the plot to The Lion King. So there's nothing here that is new as far as the plot is concerned. So the movie begins. Watching this, I mean, for starters, what Favreau did with The Jungle Book a few years ago was him and Disney, all the people that were involved with that, were smart enough to not just do a shot-for-shot recreation of that movie.
Yeah, okay? By the way, Eric, The Jungle Book was a real big movie for me as a kid. I don't remember exactly. It may have been the first movie I ever saw in a movie theater. It's either that or Herbie the Love Bug. It's either those.
Okay.
Those are either two. But the Jungle Book was a big part of my childhood, and I went in to the live action version just like with the lowest expectations. Like, do not ruin my childhood, dude. Don't do it. And I really liked the Favreau version of Jungle
it's
Book.
Good.
I was surprised. I think it's a terrific movie. So
yeah, it's good. And another thing that, maybe I'll circle back upon this, that I think benefits the Jungle Book as compared to this Lion King, is that it actually has a human character in it. It's one thing to do something where you're recreating an animated film with human characters that are going to have CGI, creations in it. We saw Beauty and the Beast and that. But to have just the animals themselves, animals and their faces and emoting is not an easy thing to accomplish outside of animation. Robert Zemeckis certainly got a lot of hell for human characters who were too creepy and photorealistic to believe in.
Especially Polar Express. That's the one that he caught the most hell for.
That was sort of the debut of that technology
right,
as well.
Right.
And people still give him hell over that.
Yeah.
With The Lion King, their faces seem to barely move at all in the film. And so there's, you're just kind of like you're hearing the lines and you're hearing the celebrity voices behind them, but you don't really feel them beyond, as like living flesh and blood characters. So to go back to, what I was saying at the beginning of the movie, it's hard to screw that part up because everybody knows the opening to The Lion King. Probably more, all the movies that have ever been created, people remember the first 5 minutes of The Lion King. That's how, that movie is ingrained into our culture. So it's kind of hard to screw that up, but at the same time, I was missing Elton John's voice during the opening of that with The Circle of Life. So, okay. But none of the songs in the movie, none of the moments of the musical numbers, and there's not a lot of them. Lion King is not a gigantic, piece of musical theater. It's got four or five songs in it, I think, the entire way, and none of them here register. None of them really work, and that's really disappointing. I think some of the voice work in the movie is really subpar.
Okay,
I cannot believe.
Eric, hang on.
Okay,
we got to take a break, and we'll jump right back into your thoughts on The Lion King. The live action version of Lion King from Disney is now out. Eric and Steve saw it. I did not, and we'll get more of Eric's thoughts, and then we'll get Steve's review of The Lion King right after we take this break on 720 WGN. Right. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It's a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're going to talk about the origins of some everyday products. We've got some TV mistakes and continuity errors that we can point out so the next time you watch some of these shows, you can laugh. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And we're talking about the movies, as we do every Monday morning. Eric Childress, Steve Procopi, helped me out reviewing all the new movies. And Eric sticks around to talk about his box office report that he writes every week. Before the break, Eric was telling us about The Lion King, and he started to tell us about what he thought of it. Let's get back to it. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay, Eric, continue with The Lion King.
Yeah, so, I mean, and this sort of this grand cavalcade of celebrity voice work that they have, you know, up and down this film, I was shocked how bad some of it was. I could not believe, I had completely forgotten that Donald Glover voices the adult Simba in the movie. And his voice work is so flat, so lifeless, and it almost seemed like sometimes that they're editing around him to make the character work, because the adult character Simba barely registers. And sometimes, but at one point, I thought they got Matthew Broderick back again to voice the character, but no, it was Donald Glover. The look of the creatures in the movie, you know, some of the special effects work very well, obviously, but like the character of Scar, for example, has a very distinct look in the animated film. It's simplistic. It's just a darker lion, and he looks a little bit more menacing, as animation can be prone to do. And here, it was just like, it seemed like they just took Mufasa and just made it look like Scar was Mufasa, just came out of the shower every time he appeared on screen. It's so distracting, and it doesn't help poor Chiwetel Ejiofor, who is not exactly doing bad voice work, but he's going up against Jeremy Irons.
Well, yeah, Eric, that's one of the greatest voice performances of all time.
It really is.
It's Jeremy Irons in The Lion King.
Villainous, certainly.
Yeah.
And his voice is so distinctive, and again, this brings me back to my point about the humans, because at least humans can give a different type of performance. They can bring something to a character, make a different slant on it. Here, you're just dealing with the voices. So you have to, you know, and so Chiwetel's doing a different voice. He's not trying to copy Jeremy Irons, obviously, but the whole character does not have the real sense of menace that he needs to make this work. And frankly, so much of it doesn't work anyway that, you know, everyone in the movie is sort of fighting an uphill battle. Again, the songs don't work. I still remember I was in the very same theater. It's remodeled now, but it's same theater back in 1994, and when I saw the animated Lion King for the first time, and the end of that movie, when Simba takes his throne and he does that slow walk, and Hans Zimmer's score elevates, I literally got the chills.
Yeah.
In the theater, watching that moment, I think one of the most beautiful moments I've ever seen in an animated film. And in this movie, they do the same thing, and I felt nothing. And it saddened me that I walked out just kind of my shoulders just sagged when they weren't just kind of shrugging the movie off the whole time. This is just it's one of these Jurassic Park moments in history where everyone was so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
Ah, I see. All right. Before we get to Steve, I want to bring my producer in, Tom, because Tom. The movie of his childhood was The Lion King, and it was like, Tom, it was like your favorite movie growing up, right?
Yeah, it was the movie that made me love movies,
which is really important.
Yeah.
You know, because we all have that movie. Everybody has that movie. Steve, I don't know what yours is. What's yours?
Oh, good Lord. I'll have to think about that.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay, because I know Eric's is E.T., right?
Oh, no, mine was definitely at a much younger age than that would have been.
Mine was Halloween.
I was gonna say maybe it's I Spit on Your Grave. I don't know. no, But the movie, I you know, it probably was like Evil Dead. I think that was the one that made me, I take that back about, I mean, it's like, yeah, that's the one that made me go, I want to know how this was made.
Yeah.
I don't just want to see it again. I want to know how it was done.
Okay. All right. So that's how you felt. So Lion King, big movie for you, Tom.
Yeah.
And you saw the new version.
I did. And I actually made, maybe it was a mistake. I watched the original because I own it in like every format. but I watched my Blu-ray copy just to remind myself about how, you know, I was like, maybe, how did I feel about this? Sometimes I have to just revisit it every once in a while. And it was like feeling like a child again. And the colors were amazing. And the performances were incredible. And it was just as good as it was back when I first saw it, probably on home video in like 1997, like 1996, 1997. And this new version is technically spectacular. Clearly, people spent thousands and thousands of hours looking at how these animals would move in real life and how they would look. And it's beautiful in that respect. But everything else is just super lame, to put it in basic terms. I think Eric really hit the nail on the head. The performances are flat and mostly uninspired. I don't think Seth Rogen has ever been more annoying in anything, really. And even Billy Eichner, who should have been a slam dunk as Timon, was like, this is fine. And there's nothing stranger than listening to Beyonce do vocal runs on Can You Feel the Love Tonight? Meanwhile, this lion is really not expressing any emotion in this amazing love song from Elton John. So, yeah, it's a disappointment through and through. It's kind of a cynical reminder of what Disney's doing to its own brand.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they've been rehashing their own stuff for a really long time. It's just never felt this obvious or this poorly executed.
Yeah. Okay. There you go. From one of the biggest fans of The Lion King ever. All right. Steve, what did you think?
Well, watching the original again was your first mistake, Tom. But no, I mean, okay, let me begin by saying not a fan of this, not recommending it. I'm going to counter a couple points that have been made and then back up a couple others. Like Tom said, the photorealistic aspect of this, from a purely technical standpoint, is above and beyond just about anything I've ever seen. Like, the realism of these animals and the landscapes is undeniable, but it's also part of the film's deeper problem, because you're sort of stripping away what makes this story magical and what makes hand-drawn animation so magical. The sense of wonder and amazement that people could draw this and bring animals to life like this, which we see all the time in animated films, but in this film it just really felt special because a lot of these animals we'd never seen in movies before. And so basically artistry in this case has been replaced by technical wizardry, which I admit is a form of art, yes. But instead of enhancing the final product, it kind of detracts from it. And for a film whose primary goal is lifelike creations, things here really do feel pretty lifeless at times. So, ironically. I will say I'm not going to dump on all the voice actors. I actually really thought, I mean, and thank goodness they were here. The times when this movie strays even a little bit from the original made me the happiest. And I think most of the stuff with Seth Rogen and Billy Eichner is not the same dialogue that they have given us before, that these characters have given us before. I thought they were pretty funny. And you can clearly tell they're improvising and just saying, they just, things are just popping out that like, it don't make any sense, and they're really funny. I actually did think Chiwetel Ejiofor was kind of mesmerizing, in part because he's not trying to copy Jeremy Irons. I think it's a delivery that kind of drips with sarcasm and bitterness, and this is maybe even more so than Jeremy Irons' performance. This time I actually felt like this guy, as bad as he is, this character Scar, as bad as he is, he really is just doing this because he feels slighted. He feels like he was sort of passed over, and we kind of get, I think, a little bit more of a sense of that. It's not an entirely different performance, but at least he's not like aping what was done before. I honestly think this is probably, using these techniques, I think this is the best version of The Lion King that Favreau could have made. That doesn't mean it should have been done, like Eric said. This should not, maybe shouldn't have been done at all. And I'm not one of those people that automatically thinks a remake is a bad thing. I think that in general with these Disney things, that the more they stray from the original, like Jungle Book does at points, the better they are. And if someone says to me, "What about Dumbo?" I'll punch you in the face because that is not a remake. It's a war wound of a film, but it's not a remake. I'm not sure much could have been done to save The Lion King from feeling soulless and pointless, but the movie illustrates that the closer you move into the real world in these kind of films, the further you get away from the beauty of the make-believe. So,
all right, there you go. Okay, guys, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
We got one more movie to review, and we will get to that after we take this break here on 720 WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here on 303 Wacker, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here till 5 a.m., and we're reviewing the new movies. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke and lots more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Eric Childress, Steve Procopi join me every Monday morning to talk about movies, and then Eric sticks around and we talk about his box office report and the numbers for the weekend. Let's bring these guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay. Steve, tell us about The Farewell.
Ah, now there's no better place we could go after The Lion King.
Yeah, I know. That's why I planned it that way, Steve. So.
Certainly one of the most talked about and critically acclaimed films that was at Sundance this year, as well as a sold-out show at the Chicago Critics Film Festival, was writer-director Lulu Wang's second feature, The Farewell, starring Awkwafina in her first lead role. Based on an incident in Lulu Wang's own family, in fact, the movie even opens with a title card that says based on an actual lie, which will make sense in a second. The Farewell concerns a Chinese family who discovers that the matriarch named Nai Nai, played by the really great veteran Chinese actress Zhao Shuzhen, that she has terminal lung cancer and only a few months left to live. In keeping with Chinese tradition, her family opts not to tell her of the seriousness of her illness, and instead arranges to have most of the extended family members fly in some cases from all over the world, to sort of say their goodbyes under the guise of a rushed wedding of one of her grandchildren. And Awkwafina plays Billy, who's a granddaughter, not the one who's getting married, but who moved to New York with her parents, played by Diane Lin and the great Zima, when she was very young, and she thinks keeping the truth from her grandmother is a mistake. So everyone suggests maybe she'd not come on the trip lest she sort of spill the beans on this big secret. But she does come against their wishes. And the film sort of follows Billy's journey back to the land of her birth, where she can either toe the family line or bring her sort of modern Western sensibilities to the situation. It's a remarkable, very funny, always highly emotional work that is probably going to make a lot of best of the year lists this year. It certainly will be one of mine, I think. And Awkwafina's dramatic turn here is a huge accomplishment and really does prove that she can carry a film without a doubt. The film provides a great deal of insight also into what it must be like for someone moving to another country where you don't know anyone and to start a new life. There are no bad guys in this story, which I also really loved. Just family members with sort of differing ideas on how to handle the situation. with this illness and whether or not to let her know. And Billy is not the only one who thinks that maybe they should tell her. It's a warm, immersive, inviting, it feels like a big hug of a movie. And although this is dealing with a Chinese family, it really could be any family from any place in the world that has strong beliefs and traditions that may not sync up with the way a lot of the world might think about something. Look at it as a learning experience with some amazing food on display and just joyousness and this really essential performance, I think, at the center. There's sort of a heartbreaking farewell sequence at the end where the family member, not when anybody dies, but I'm saying when the family leaves China and goes back to America, tears are going to flow. But there's a really sort of uplifting feeling to the entire piece thanks to a parting title card just before the end credits. I won't ruin that. And by the end, it all feels like home to us. And I know that I miss this place and miss these characters already. So I went and actually just saw the film again today just to sort of remind myself what I thought of it. And I still think it's one of the best films of the year.
Okay. All right, Eric.
Yeah, I adore this movie ever since I saw it at Sundance. I did want to really quickly correct something, not just Steve, but also myself. And many times I've talked about this film before. The director's name is actually Lulu Wong, just so we have that going forward. But, yeah, I mean, this is a movie that, you know, there are a lot of movies that we've seen that are about grief and loss and family and things like that. But I think this is one of the best movies I've ever seen about avoiding grief and, you know, the way that grief, you know, is its own sort of cancer that, you know, can brew up inside of you, and you can let it out. You can, you know, deal with it in your own way. And, you know, that's, you know, exactly what's going on in this movie with this family. And, you know, whether or not it's a cultural item that you agree with as being an American is concerned, I think it makes for sort of an interesting discussion. Anyone who's had to deal with any kind of loss in their life, you know, what is the proper way to deal with it? You know, would someone have lived longer if, you know, they didn't have the burden, which is basically what the Chinese culture preaches, that, you know, someone, you know, diagnosed with such an illness, if they know they're going to die, does that affect them in such a way that it just speeds up the illness? You know, Awkwafina, who is about ready to just sort of blow up in film, basically, she's being cast in everything right now. I don't know when we're going to see a better performance from her than we see in this movie, because she, you know, she's been in a few things that we've seen. She's hosted SNL, certainly, so she's definitely out there. But her work in this movie, I think it's one of the best performances of the year, and everyone is so good in this movie. It's one of these movies that's going to make you cry multiple times throughout. Different things, again, depending on your own personal experience, where you're at, as confronting, you know. And I also think this is one of the better movies that I've seen about that kind of personal relationship between, you know, a grandparent and a grandchild, and things like that. I think that the relationship between the two of them is really special, and considering that throughout the whole movie they're coming at it from completely two different perspectives, it brings an extra level of pain and humanity to it all. But as Steve said, you know, this is a movie that is definitely going to make people cry and going to create a lot of hugs for family members by the time it's all over. But I promise everyone who goes to see it, they will leave with a great big smile on their face at the end of this movie. This is a movie that I think is going to blow up the rest of the summer.
I agree with you. It's one of the best movies of the year. It is. It's absolutely amazing. And every performance in this movie is stunning. But man, Awkwafina, you know, and I've been a fan of hers, you know, kind of since the beginning. I liked her in Ocean's 8. I think mm-hmm. she's really, you know, like her music career is really kind of fun, and I thought she was terrific on SNL. But this is just wow. I mean, where did that come from? She's so great in this movie, and the thing that I loved most about it is that I learned something. You know, like this is a culture mm-hmm. about this culture. and I found it fascinating and really interesting. And you know, I just wanted to mention, you know, Crazy Rich Asians from last year, which was a very entertaining movie, made a ton of money and really blew up. But it seemed a little bit a lot more westernized, if you know what I mean, than this film. This is a movie that was like, we're gonna show you what it's like in this culture, but we are not gonna make it Western. You know what I mean? This is a movie where if you're from the West, you're an American or whatever, and you see this movie, it's not going to be sort of like your generic sort of rom-com, which Crazy Rich Asians was, as good as it was. You know what I mean? But there's something deeper and more significant about this movie. It is. I cried like a maniac during this movie. I mean, I think people wanted to call EMTs at one point. I got invested into these characters, and I never had a grandfather. Both my parents' fathers passed away before I was born, and I only had one grandmother till I was 10, and another till I was 18. So I never had the opportunity to be an adult with a grandmother. You know what I mean? So to see this kind of thing, that also destroyed me during the movie. You know, like, so people are going to blink, like both of you guys said, Eric, especially you said you're going to bring your own personal, you know, baggage to this movie, because everybody has dealt with this kind of stuff before. Everybody deals with grief. Everybody deals with disease, and how the family deals with it is an incredibly complicated thing. And it's an incredibly complicated thing in this movie. But the casting in this movie, it's beautifully written. It's beautifully directed. Every single emotion is covered in this movie. It's a joyous experience. I adore this movie. I absolutely adore it. I agree with you guys completely. It's absolutely one of the best movies of the year. It's only playing in 3 theaters now, but it's going to open wide. And like you, I agree with you, Eric. This thing is going to blow up. I think it's going to be really, really big.
So. Yeah, it's actually, I think it's going to expand a little bit wider next week, and then on August 2nd, it's supposed to go a bit more nationwide.
Okay. All right, so we got Tarantino's movie next week, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. Steve, thanks, buddy.
Yes, thanks.
All right, we'll talk to you soon, and yep. Eric, you hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right, we got to take a break for the news here, and when we come back, we'll talk box office with Eric Childress right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about some pretty insane origin stories of everyday products. We got some hidden treasures that are actually worth nothing. And we're going to talk about some TV show errors that you can spot. And right now we've reviewed all the new movies. The one to see, as we mentioned before the news, is The Farewell with Awkwafina. It is really one of the very best movies of the year. But every week we do talk box office. Eric writes a box office report. And Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay. The Lion King, $185 million, if I'm not mistaken. The people who were making the predictions were right on.
Yeah, this is one of the rare occasions in some time where they really kind of just hit the nail on the head. They said about $185 million throughout the whole weekend. There was, you know, talk that it might get up to 200, maybe over 200 plus. Then it was like maybe somewhere between 192 and 200, and ultimately fell back on $185 million. And it's made over $534 million worldwide.
Yeah.
In 10 days of release. It opened in China last week. So it's only 3 days of domestic, 10 days of worldwide, and it's already $534 million.
That's insane. Wow.
Yep.
That's crazy. Not surprising, though. Not really surprising.
Nope, not
hey,
at all.
Before we get to the rest of the top 10, some big box office news in terms of Endgame.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, it was, you know, Kevin, the San Diego Comic-Con has been going on this past week,
right.
And the big Marvel presentation was Saturday night, and even though the final numbers were not in for the weekend, Kevin Feige, you know, took the stage and proudly announced that Avengers Endgame had overtaken Avatar as the highest grossing film ever worldwide.
Isn't that insane?
Yeah, and thankfully the reports are that they sort of found some extra money from overseas, so I don't know exactly where they, quote-unquote, found some extra money, but they did.
Yeah,
so that sort of closed the gap a little quicker than people were expecting. The movie was about $7 million away going into the weekend.
Yeah.
And by Saturday night, they were proclaiming victory. And by the end of Sunday, as far as the reports are concerned, it has passed Avatar.
Yeah, well, they had to make the announcement. You know that.
Right.
They had to at Comic-Con.
Yeah.
You can't pass up that, you know, that opportunity.
Exactly.
So, all right. Well, there it is. Avengers Endgame, biggest movie ever made, which is really insane.
When you think about it, Nick, I mean, if you look at the history of the box office, since 1975, it's been Spielberg, Lucas, Cameron, and the Russo brothers have all owned the top grossing film of all time.
The Russo brothers. All right.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Okay, let's get back to the top ten. Speaking of Marvel. It just doesn't stop, does it?
No.
Spider-Man Far From Home, $21 million. It's up to $319 million domestically.
Yeah, it's going to make a run at $400 million. It's on pace for that right now. I think, you know, the Tarantino movies, I mean, it's not going to cut into that so much. It's going to have pretty much all of August to stay in the top 10. So it's already $889 million worldwide. So this thing's headed for $1 billion as well.
Insane. Insane. Mm-hmm. Number three, Toy Story 4. Boy, everything is Disney in the top. It's all Disney in the top three.
Yeah.
$14.6 million, $375 million domestically.
Yeah, remember a couple weeks ago, Toy Story 4, what a disappointment it made when it only made like $120 million when it opened.
Yeah.
Yeah, $377 million in domestic. It's probably going to finish somewhere around around 415, 420, again, over $850 million worldwide. That's headed for $1 billion as well.
Yeah, God. Is Crawl headed for $1 billion?
It is not.
$6 million.
But it is comfortably headed for somewhere between like $35 and $38 million, which, you know, adding a couple extra bucks overseas has made about almost another $10 million internationally right now. And so it's about a $16 million production, something like that.
Yeah.
It's going to be in profit.
Okay, good.
Your alligator movie is going to be successful.
Very cool. All right, number five, Yesterday. What a success story this is. $5 million, $58 million about right now, and this has turned out to be a great hit for Danny Boyle.
Yeah, this is a movie that, until the movie that we've just been talking about, I think is the movie that adults have been sort of headed out. You know, all the spectacles and Disney and Marvel stuff that's come out, this is the one that sort of sparked, like, oh, let's go see something that's about people and music and stuff. And this movie, it looks like it's probably going to be headed somewhere over $70 million, which is a real success.
Okay. And then Stuber, $4 million, $16 million in 2 weeks. Yeah.
Yeah, no, this movie is pretty much on the same trajectory that Midsommar is on. So both of those movies are probably going to finish up somewhere around $25 million.
Yeah.
So, and Stuber cost like $26 million, I think.
Yeah.
So that's going to be a failure.
Aladdin, good lord. 3.8. Let's get back to Disney, everybody. 3.8 million, $340 million total. Bigger than anybody expected, or at least you and I.
Yeah, certainly, and the movie just kept going. Like, I thought it would open well and then maybe die off pretty quickly, but no, it's maintained its pace, and it is $12 million shy of $1 billion. Yeah, and also Disney now with Lion King, which has now had the ninth highest opening of all time with $185 million. Disney, 12 of the top 13 opening weekends are owned by Disney.
That's unbelievable! Wow.
Yeah.
Number eight, Annabelle Comes Home, $2.6 million, $22.4 million total. How's that compared to the other?
A little less than the other ones. The other ones finished around between like $250 and $300 million worldwide. This one is just about a $200 million worldwide. Again, small budgeted film. This is a pretty major success.
Okay, Midsommar, $1.5 million, $18 million total.
Yeah.
In 3 weeks.
Yeah, we this is the movie that we all wish was doing better, but it never had a chance.
No, it didn't.
With subject matter and audiences, you know, clearly not buying it.
Yeah. And then number 10, Secret Life of Pets 2, clinging in there into the top 10, $1.5 million, $151 million, real big drop, as we've talked about, from the first one.
Like $600 million drop.
Jeez.
From the first one. I have to go back and do some research to see if there's ever been a sequel drop that far on the scale. Because I don't know if there has been.
No. All right. Well, what are we looking at next week? Lion King still number one, correct?
Lion King will still be number one, yeah. I mean, I think that'll probably drop to probably maybe around 75 to 85 million, maybe something like that. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood should be a pretty solid second, probably in the 30s,
yeah.
I'm thinking.
Yeah.
It's been pretty well advertised. Maybe they could get that thing over 40. I'm not sure what the extension of Farewell is going to be next week. I think it's getting a little bit of a bigger release, so maybe that can sneak into the top 10 next week.
Yeah.
It wasn't in the top 10 this week, but it was only in 35 theaters.
Yeah,
it made $1.17 million, which is
very
right
impressive.
Along the lines of The Kids Are All Right and Lady Bird and The Boyhood made in their second weekend, and those movies all went out to have a pretty solid box office for independent movies. And like you, I think the Farewell, once this thing expands, I think this movie is going to play like gangbusters the rest of the summer.
I totally agree with you, man. And by the way, we didn't mention what theaters it's playing in Chicago, and you should definitely make the trip to see.
And it's a PG movie too, people.
Yeah, exactly. It's PG. It's a wonderful movie. Really, really, really wonderful. One of the truly one of the best movies of the year. It's at the AMC River East downtown. It's at the Landmark Century Cinema on Clark and Diversey, and it's at the Century 12 in Evanston. Make that trip to see. It's a very special movie, a very,
definitely,
very special movie. So you're thinking about 30 million or so for Tarantino. What's Tarantino's biggest opening?
Oh, was it Django or Inglorious Bastards?
I think it's Inglorious. My guess would be Inglorious Bastards because Brad Pitt's in it. So that would have been my guess. But you got DiCaprio and Pitt in this one.
It could be big, but it's a long movie. It's an R-rated film. We'll see. Hateful Eight didn't do great.
Yeah, it didn't.
Remember, so we'll see exactly if people show for this. The hype has been there. The reviews are certainly very good for it. I think that we'll see.
Yeah. Well, I'm are you there, Eric?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you got cut off. I also want to remind people that obviously it's going to be opening in wide. It's got a big wide release, right? Hollywood.
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. But it is playing in 70mm at the Music Box starting on Thursday.
That's correct.
If anybody wants to check it out in 70, I know my producer Tom's going on Thursday to check it out in 70. If you want to see it in 70mm at the beautiful Music Box Theater, 70mm in all its glory. Which, by the way, I did go to the Roadshow back in 2015 when Hateful Eight opened, and I saw it at the Music Box with the intermission and with the program. One of my favorite cinematic experiences ever, and I'm not kidding. I just thought it was amazing, all of that. So experience it in 70mm at the beautiful Music Box Theater starting on Thursday, and it'll open wide on Friday, and then we'll find out exactly how much it will make. What else is coming out? What else is coming out next week?
That's the only major release next week.
Okay. Well, that's okay. And so that's why Lion King will still be number one.
Exactly.
Nothing going on. And then beginning of August, we've got the Hobbs and Nobbs. What the hell is
Hobbs and Nobbs?
Yeah. Is that going to be number one when it comes out?
Yes.
Yeah, I would
think
so.
Yeah, by the time that comes out, it'll knock Lion King off the throne.
Yeah, I mean, it's a Fast and Furious presents.
That's right.
Ridiculous. I'll probably end up loving it.
Probably.
Yeah. All right, Eric, thanks, man. We'll talk next week.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
There you go. Eric Childress, everybody. You can read his box office reports, and you can hear him here with Steve Procopi reviewing all the new movies, as we do every week. Okay, we're going to take a break right here on 720 WGN.
The bells all ring, girl, it's getting late. The train's pulling out, there's no time to waste. Now you better move fast.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. We are also going to talk about some continuity errors and other mistakes that have been broadcast on television in many, many shows. And we got a list of that, and that's going to be fun to talk about. And our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And if you want to join us, talk and text, 312-981-7200. Okay. We come across items, products, things, everyday items. And sometimes we don't know where the history of that comes from or what the origins are. And there are some really weird and kind of interesting and fascinating and sometimes crazy origin stories for where these everyday items come from. The intro to this piece, this was also on cracked.com if you want to check it out. And by the way, you can follow us on Facebook. That's the best way to stay connected, because whatever's happening on the show is happening on the Facebook page. So if you want to see this article in all its glory, it is hooked up on our Facebook page right now, linked up. So go to Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. So the intro to this says, the creative process is way more complicated and convoluted than the history books and talk shows let on. Products go through an insane amount of iterations before they reach their final form. Sometimes they wind up utterly unrecognizable when they finally hit the shelves. So we asked readers to dig up everyday products and find some of their truly bizarre histories. So here we go. Tea bags were created by accident. They were created by accident. How many cups of tea do you get out of one bag?
I usually do two.
Do you do two?
Yeah. If I'm making a single cup, like if I'm doing it just one tea bag, I usually do two. But if I'm making a pot of tea, usually I'll throw about three or four tea bags in there.
Yeah.
That usually takes care of it.
Yeah.
But I was also raised by a very frugal Irish woman. So she's like, you get the most out of tea bags you can get.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I always ask people how many cups of tea they get out of their tea bag. I would do, you know, when I don't drink tea. I mean, I've had, you know, I get decaf every once in a while, cause I don't do the caffeine, but I get decaf every once in a while. And the only reason I drink, hot tea now is if I have like a throat issue or something. And, I usually get two bags. I get, one bag, two cups. So that almost sounded like that terrible video. All right. Anyway, they were created by accident. 1908, Thomas Sullivan, a New York tea merchant, started to send samples of tea to his customers in small silken bags. But a lot of people assumed that these were supposed to be used as the popular metal infusers, you know, the fantastic little snapping metal case with the holes in it, like a colander on the chain. And that's what you put in. Do you have one of those? I'm assuming you do.
I actually don't. I mainly just use regular tea bags. I go to World Market, get my boxes of berries tea from Ireland, and that's what I use. But my girlfriend is more into some of the more artisanal teas with like flowers and almonds in them.
Yeah.
So she's got a little, it's a plastic one that's shaped like a manatee, and it sits on the side of the cup. It's the manatee.
Oh, that's pretty, manatee.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny.
But I'm more of a traditionalist.
Yeah.
I just use the tea bags.
Did you ever, you know, they got these videos that circulate on the internet. Have you ever noticed that there are some videos on the internet?
Yeah. I think there's a couple.
Couple.
I've seen.
But there's a one where there's like a thing, and I can't remember whether I think it might be Vanity. It might be Vanity Fair, who does a series of like interviews with celebrities, and then they also do what are the secret talents of celebrities? Like so they show like celebrities doing things. Did you ever see the video? I can't tell you how many times I've watched it because I think it's so charming and lovely. Do you ever see the video of Saoirse Ronan just making a pot of tea?
No.
Oh, you got to see it.
Oh yeah,
you got to see it.
Well, she probably makes a good cup of.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, she. The topic of tea, every time, and I've seen every interview with Saoirse Ronan because
I'm
totally smitten with her. I think she's just adorable and I love her. And the best accent in the world, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, and I think the Irish accent, by the way, is the greatest accent of all time. But anyway, it was like, what's your special talent? And her special talent is making the perfect pot of tea. And so it's just her making tea, you know, and it's I've watched it like 900 times. And it's just fantastic. But anyway, by putting the entire bag in the pot, which is what they did, so they put the silken bag in the pot, rather than emptying out the contents or using the actual metal infuser, the bag was born.
And it's a convenience, really.
It is.
It saves you a lot of time, and really, you get just as good a cup of tea.
No, yeah, absolutely.
Unless you ask, like, the real hardcore people.
Yeah, my ex-wife had one of those the metal infuser things, and she went and she used to go nuts with it.
I'm always shocked at how many types of tea there are.
Oh, my God.
Like, there's sleepy time tea. There's different kinds of herbal teas that are supposed to make you feel certain ways.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. I know. My ex.
She did the whole thing.
She was just tea woman.
She was Mrs. T.
She was Mrs. That's right. She was Mrs. T. That's right. Yeah.
I have been pitying fools for 28 years, Bill, and it's never personal.
Well, I have to say, you have a number of Mr. T.
Hey, sucker, you better not be talking to invisible animals. 1 out of 1 Dr. T's recommended. Shut up, fool.
Now, that's from the talking little mini
Mr. T.
Mr. T, yeah, it's like a little doll.
I pity the fool. Don't make me mad. Don't give me no back talk, sucker. Don't give me no back talk, sucker. First name, Mr. Middle name, period. Last name, T.
That might be my favorite.
Quit your jibber jabber.
But this was actually in an interview with Bill O'Reilly.
I have been pitying fools for 28 years, Bill, and it's never personal.
He was on Bill O'Reilly because he did that controversial Snickers commercial where it was like double entendre because it was like, enjoy my nuts.
No.
And so people were getting like angry about it, and he had to come on Bill O'Reilly, which of course was like ridiculous.
Yeah.
But people were like, we don't think that that's funny. And then he replied with,
I have been pitying fools for 28 years, Bill, and it's never personal.
That's right.
Good old Mr. T.
One of my favorite Mr. T stories, my buddy Mike View was driving down Michigan Avenue, and it was like a summer day. It was a nice day. And he gets to the intersection of Chicago and Michigan. He's going south on Michigan. He gets to it's right by the water tower.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's there at Chicago and Michigan, and he's sitting there, and he notices a bunch of people. Obviously, it's very busy. You know, Michigan Avenue in Chicago, that's intersection is one of the most busiest in the city. And it was the middle of the beautiful afternoon, summer afternoon, and lots of people are in the crosswalk crossing the street at the red light. And he starts to notice a whole bunch of people like pointing and going, hey, and their eyes lighting up and some people clapping. He looks over to his left and there's Mr. T. Okay. So he's in his convertible Rolls Royce. He's got the mohawk, the feathered earrings, the 9,000 chains, the whole thing. And he's sitting there. Everybody's like, Mr. T. And he's like, hey, how you doing, everybody? And he's like waving and everything. And then Mike says he looked over, and hanging from Mr. T's rearview mirror was a Mr. T air freshener.
Oh, wow.
And he said, you know you've made it when you're in a convertible Rolls Royce. And people are waving at you. Thousands of people love you, and they're waving at you. And you're in your car, and you have an air freshener of yourself.
That is surreal.
That's fantastic. I also love that. You're probably too young to remember the story when he moved to Lake Forest.
No, he was living in Lake Forest.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, no, he still lives here.
Still lives here.
Yeah, he lives in a high rise where Andrea Darlis used to live. She was like neighbors with Mr. T.
Can you?
And would see him in the laundry
hey,
room.
Andrea, like, love that report this weekend.
Yeah, would see him in the gym and would see him in the laundry room. Like, Mr. T, you know, like, Mr. T's got to do his laundry too, you know. So, anyway, when he moved to Lake Forest, he hired a company to start chopping down trees because he didn't want trees around his
his
property. So I would always say, well, Mr. T, you might not want to move to a place called Lake Forest if you don't want trees. So it was a big controversy when he lived there. Like, he was cutting down all these trees, and the people in Lake Forest hated it. And so, but anyway, it was Mr. T. He's the man. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back, and we'll talk about some more interesting and crazy origin stories for everyday products. The news is coming up right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on Wacker in downtown Chicago. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're also going to talk about some of the errors that actually aired on television shows. Got past the people who check continuity and things like that. And our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. So good morning, everyone. Hey, we are talking about everyday products and their origin stories. Some of them are really interesting and goofy. Some of them are crazy. And that's what we're talking about here. If you want to jump in with a talk or a text, or if you know the origin story of a certain product or the history of some of the things that we buy and see every day, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Okay, how about aviator sunglasses? They're going to come back into vogue again because of that that damn Top Gun movie.
I'm guessing you're not a fan.
No.
Really? You don't love the volleyball sequence?
Well, listen,
from the original?
No. No. And I think, you know, look, and I really like everybody in that movie. I just think the movie's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, it's
absolutely ridiculous. And it epitomizes the 80s. Like, if you right. want if you want a quintessential example of mid-80s,
mm-hmm.
Top Gun. And I'm I'm a big fan, as you know. I'm a big fan of Tom Cruise. I love Tom Cruise. And I mean, obviously he was a movie star when that movie came out. I mean, he still is, but like at that time, you know, he was the biggest movie star on the planet. But now I'm not a big. I think the aerial sequences are really well done. You know, there's no denying that a lot of the aerial sequences are really cool and well done. But I just thought that movie was stupid.
I think someone that we both know, I believe, is Mike Vanderbilt from Daily Grindhouse.
Yes.
Posited this. What is Top Gun actually about? What is that movie actually about other than people flying planes?
No. Well, I guess it's supposed to be about the redemption of Maverick's character. I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
I remember my girlfriend at the time, we went to go see it and at the screening of it, and she was like, during that volleyball scene, she literally was digging her nails into my arm. I'm not kidding.
Just in a cold sweat.
She was just like digging her nails into my arm, and I'm like, how can I compete? How can I compete with what's on screen right now?
Oh, well, you got Tom Cruise, Val Kilmer.
Yeah.
The whole crew, man.
The whole crew. I don't remember who else is in that movie. I know what the nerds. Who ends up dead in the movie.
Oh, yeah, Goose.
Yeah. Meg Ryan.
Meg Ryan's in it.
Anthony Edwards.
Anthony Edwards, yeah, that's it.
Well, Tom Jennifer... Skerritt.
True.
Is Michael Ironside in it? Am I nuts?
I think so. He definitely is.
James Tolkien, the bald dude from Back to the Future.
Right.
He's in it.
Well, Jennifer Connelly is going to be in this new one.
I know.
And she's been, what, 4 decades of everybody's biggest crush?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I still think that the scene in Career Opportunities where she's on the horse should be mandatory in film school that you study that scene over and over and over again. That's
just a bunch of people. Yes,
yeah,
okay,
this
I see.
Is fantastic
for research.
So, yeah. So she's in the Snowpiercer TV series?
I did see that. One, I was kind of shocked to find out that they were making a Snowpiercer
first
TV
of all,
series.
Yeah, but I mean, Snowpiercer rules.
Great.
That movie is just fantastic.
I just didn't know it warranted a series.
Exactly. Like, I thought maybe 7 of us saw that movie, which I believe is the case. Not many people have seen that movie, despite the fact that Chris Evans is in it.
Mm-hmm.
And Tilda Swinton in that movie. Oh, my God.
Even Octavia Spencer
is
in it. It's so weird.
It's a terrific movie. But like, a really, really great movie. But I can't believe they're making a series out of it.
Didn't we say all we needed to say with just Snowpiercer? I feel like they kind of... beginning, middle,
very
end,
strange.
Handled it.
Hey, listen, if it gets more people to watch the movie,
sure,
I'm all for it. But anyway, aviator sunglasses were nicknamed after the test pilots who first used them. USAF Lieutenant John McCready?
R.J. McCready?
There's only one person on the planet with the name McCready, and that's R.J. McCready. With his big sombrero. John McCready partnered with a goggle manufacturer to design lenses with a distinctive shape and extra dark tint after a friend of his was nearly blinded at high altitude when using his eyes froze after removing fogged over goggles. Good Lord. All right, so there's aviator sunglasses. Yeah, you know, Tom Cruise is responsible for making two kinds of sunglasses very popular. The Wayfarer and the Aviator.
I mean, you don't become an icon without, you know, taking a few products with you.
How about this one? One of the early prototypes of the waterbed was a chair filled with Jell-O. It was deemed too smelly and heavy, you think?
But it was edible.
I got this chair filled with Jell-O, if anybody would like to come over and sit on it. Commercial fertilizers The invention that fed countless of people were invented by Fritz Haber, the same man who created the deadly chlorine gas during World War One.
It's kind of like how the Nobel Peace Prize comes from the guy who invented dynamite.
Right. How about this? The inventor of the ATM was inspired by chocolate bar dispensers. And the four-digit PIN was chosen because his wife could not memorize six numbers. All right, that's pretty funny. I wonder how did she not know her own phone number?
Well, back in that back in those days,
well, they were seven numbers. Still seven numbers, even without the.
That's true. When I and this is obviously showing how young I am. When did ATMs start coming around?
Early '80s. Early 80s. I mean, okay. It probably was before that, but I started noticing them in the early 80s. And they were called, at first, they were Money Network.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of the very first one that I remember seeing was Money Network.
I think you can still see some of those. They're real old, but...
Yeah, I mean, but... And the other thing is, not every bank at all had ATMs. This was like in the middle of the mall, a couple here and there. They were kind of hard to find. But then... It switched over, and this was for years, it was Cash Station with the green, you know, the logo.
Yeah, I recognize that.
Cash Station, that was the one. And then suddenly ATMs were popping up everywhere.
And every bank had their ATM.
Yeah, well, not then. I mean,
but
once the Cash Station thing took off for a few years, then every bank had independent, and there were ATMs everywhere, and that's when the little ones started showing up in your 7-Elevens and all that
stuff.
Yeah. But it was mostly, it started out as Money Network, and then it was Cash Station.
Cash Station.
How about in the 19th century, gunpowder was often made with urine because it is rich in nitrates. A beer drinker's urine was preferable to that of a sober person, but a wine drinker's urine was the best to make gunpowder. salt was used as a currency. Oh, yes, I do know this. I knew this one. It was one of the greatest treasures of the ancient world and was traded ounce for gold. Greek traders exchanged their slaves for salt. Roman soldiers were partly paid in salt, which was known as Cerealium Argentum, in which we derived the English word salary.
Oh. Now that is interesting.
It is. So the word salary comes from the Roman phrase for salt.
I wonder if that's where we also get the idiom, if someone's worth their salt.
Yeah, I bet it is. I bet that's where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
How about this? Minoxidil, the main ingredient in hair treatment products such as Rogaine, was originally developed in the 60s to treat hypertension. That was until they realized that rapid hair growth was one of its side effects.
So now you can have low blood pressure.
Wait. I think I figured out what, you know, like Lou Manfredini can change his life once again. Cuz you know he does commercials for the hair restoration. Like he went to, I can't remember what company it was, he endorses one of those hair restoration things.
Yeah.
And you know he was on Seattle Sutton cuz he has hypertension.
Yeah.
Look at this, minoxidil. That's what you need, Lou.
There you go.
Take care of the whole thing. You lower your blood pressure and grow a bunch of hair.
Amazing. The miracles of modern medicine.
Oh, man. Alka-Seltzer is a knockoff of a home remedy for the flu. Hub Beardsley. Wow, that's a name. Hub Beardsley.
There.
President of Miles Labs created Alka-Seltzer by closely imitating a local newspaper editor's flu home remedy, which was aspirin and baking soda. And as a rigorous scientific test to see if his new product worked, he took a supply with him on a Mediterranean cruise and distributed it to the passengers with the flu. So he did a test on a cruise with
a bunch of sick people.
That's hilarious. Yeah, you people are stuck on this boat, so you have no choice but to try my Alka-Seltzer.
I got to ask, when's the last time you actually took an Alka-Seltzer?
Oh, it's been a long time.
Yeah,
I have Alka-Seltzer cold medicine in my cabinet at home, my medicine cabinet at home. I haven't taken it in a while. Okay, I bet you know what? I'll have to check the date on that.
Yeah,
so
I'd be curious because I've never actually taken an Alka-Seltzer before.
You seriously?
Yeah, just I mean, you know, whenever I was sick, we had Tylenol or whatever. Yeah. When it came to the flu, we went to the got a prescription.
Yeah, Alka-Seltzer.
Thermaflu, I guess.
Alka-Seltzer is more of is for stomach upset. That's what it's mostly for. Is for, you know, acid indigestion and stuff. That's what the Alka-Seltzer is for. Makes you burp. One of those things you sit there, you drink a bunch of Alka-Seltzer, and you burp for 45 minutes. It's really quite fun. Okay, we're going to take a quick break here. And when we come back, we've got more interesting and goofy and sometimes crazy origin stories for everyday products. And if you want to jump in with comments or questions, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Oh, I love this song. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. That's Level 42, featuring maybe one of the greatest bass players of all time, frontman Mark King. I love that band for several reasons, because their music rules also, but their name is a reference to Hitchhiker's Guide. So, another reason to love them. So... all right, everybody. Hi, it's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We are going to talk about some blatant mistakes and continuity errors that got past all the people and actually ended up on some good TV shows. You can spot them in reruns. Phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. If you know the origins of some everyday products, you want to share some of the stories or some of the things that you've learned about the history of certain things, jump in here at 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about some interesting and crazy origin stories of everyday products. Like, how about Vaseline? And by the way, that's the name of the movie. That's the name of the movie Grease. I can't remember what country, but it's called,
yeah, Vaseline.
It's called Vaseline with John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John. Vaseline originated as a byproduct of the oil drilling process. In 1859, British chemist Robert Augustus Chesebrough visited a small town in Pennsylvania where petroleum had been discovered. He noticed Vaseline's skin healing properties after seeing how oilers used to heal up cuts and burns. Yes.
I used to use it on my nose when I would get a cold.
Oh, yeah.
You know how your skin gets
all dry and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. It's great.
You know what? The only type of tissue I use, except when I'm here, when I blow my nose, is the Vicks infused puffs. Have you ever tried the Vicks infused puffs?
I have not.
Oh, man. It's lovely. It's just lovely. It's got the lotion, and when you inhale or when you blow your nose, you get that Vicks thing right up into your. It's fantastic. It's Vicks infused puffs. I don't have any stock in the company or anything.
No,
but that's the tissue that I use when I blow my nose. Vicks infused puffs. It's great when you have a cold. It's fantastic. It's even awesome when you don't. So I blow my nose pretty frequently.
Yeah.
Which is why I have a roll of toilet paper here. A lot of people come into the studio and they move my toilet paper. I have a roll of toilet paper right there. And people like to mess around in the studio here. I come in and I'm like, I got to fix everything. You know, I don't like sharing this studio.
If we could, we'd just get you a little private one.
My own studio. That's what this is. But I don't share it with many.
No.
Because almost everybody else at the station uses A.
I'm trying to think who you share.
Williams.
Grzanich, William, JW.
And then I think Bill and Wendy do their extra hour here.
No, bonus hour is still out of A.
How is that possible? Because something's on air at that time.
Yeah, so it's Bertrand.
Bertrand, is he in here?
Yeah, Bertrand's in here.
Oh, Bertrand's in here, so they stay in. Okay,
yeah,
so
they
it's
stay
Bert-
in A.
Okay,
Bertrand
okay.
comes out of here.
So Bertrand.
And so does JW.
And then JW is right after Bertrand.
Yep, yep.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
So it's one of those chuckleheads.
Yeah. No, on the weekends.
No, it's on the
on the weekends, you got Noonan in here.
I could see Noonan.
Yeah, beer cans all over the place. I'm not kidding.
Scoundrel.
I think he had some beer dudes
in. He did
because
his brewery thing.
There was you know, cans of beer in here.
Yeah, there's a few tins in here as well.
Yeah. So but yeah, I mean, I realize I share the space and everything, but I'm very, as you know, the first thing I do when I get here, Tom, as you know, I have to set this,
yeah,
to my specific you know.
Well, all I'm going to say is the instant replay does say Studio DiGilio.
It does, because this is Studio D.
And Studio DiGilio.
That's my buddy Bob Ferguson did that.
Good old Fergie.
Good old Fergie. He came in here because this is my instant replay sound effect machine that has, like, this stuff on it.
All right.
That kind of stuff. It's got a label on it that says Studio D, but then he wrote Studio D with a space, DiGilio. So that's what it says. But anyway, how'd we get on this? Oh, tissues, right?
Tissues, yeah.
So anyway, get the puffs, the Vicks infused puffs.
I know a lot of people are very much soothed by Vicks vapor rub or Vicks smelling anything, because when they were children,
absolutely,
they would get that a lot.
But my mom would rub it on my chest if I was it's comfort. It's like a comfort smell. There's a lot of and smells, by the way, are one of the most. I think smell is perhaps the most intense of all senses.
In terms of, especially
related to memories. No question about it.
Mm-hmm.
No question about it. How about this? Mass-produced chewing gum came out of an attempt to reinstate a Mexican dictator.
What?
Exiled to America, General De Santa Anna planned to take back the Mexican presidency with a personal army. To raise it, he needed a fortune. So he worked with an inventor named Thomas Adams on turning chicle into a marketable rubber substitute. They failed, but Adams thought chewable chicle could sell, which led to the invention of mass-produced chewing gum.
Chiclets.
That's where the name Chiclets comes from.
Well.
Do you ever see the footage of, you know, I'm not a basketball fan by any stretch of the imagination. But I do enjoy watching the footage of the commentary and the byplay between Shaq and Charles Barkley, because Charles Barkley is hilarious.
Oh, yeah, he's a funny guy.
They were talking about, Shaq was like, why don't you tell everybody how you what you do when you're done chewing gum? And Charles Barkley's like, I swallow it. Everybody swallows gum when they're done. And he's like, No, they don't,
Charles Barkley.
And
no,
again,
they don't.
Kenan Thompson. I was doing Kenan Thompson doing Charles Barkley. Yeah, he swallows his gum. You remember the old wives' tale? It's like, swallow your gum, it's going to take 7 years to digest.
I believed it for a solid period of time.
I think it's gross to swallow gum.
Oh, yeah, you shouldn't do it. It's not good for you, but...
No. I just spit it out. I don't chew much gum anymore, but when I did, I used to spit it out.
Yeah, you
swallow your gum.
or you stick it to the bottom of your desk so that the teacher doesn't give you a detention.
Yeah. All right, we got a break here. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. The news is coming up right after this. Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories of a beautiful downtown Chicago, and we are here until 5 a.m. Again, Tom, I might be a little distracted here because it's another Aisha Tyler Friends episode.
Nice.
So I might find myself just distracted because she's on screen right now. Sometimes I can't speak when I see Aisha Tyler. I love her so much.
She is breathtaking.
Oh, my God. All right. Hey, welcome back here, everybody. Hey, coming up, we're going to talk about some of the most infamous errors in TV. I'll give you the example for the first one. True Blood. They had a flashback episode on True Blood that took place in, like, 86 or 87, and they were in a video store, and there were signs that said DVDs coming soon. DVDs weren't around at that time. It took place in the early 90s or mid-90s or something. And they were talking about how the DVDs were... Nope.
Not quite.
Nope. Unless True Blood turned into a time travel show. So, we are talking about the origins. Sometimes they're fun, sometimes they're weird, and sometimes they're crazy. Of certain everyday products that we know. 312-981-7200. And we were talking before, before the break, I was highly recommending to Tom that he pick up the Vicks infused puffs, which is the only tissue that I use. I love them. And then we get a text from someone, 219 area code, And this is true. It says Vicks-infused puffs were great until my wife accidentally used them to wipe tears out of her eyes, and then she was really crying. Yeah, you don't want to. You don't want to. I should have. Maybe I should have specifically said this is for blowing your nose, not for, you know, if you have tissues because you're watching, you know, because you're watching Up, the first 10 minutes of Up. You might want to just have regular puffs or regular Kleenex next to the Vicks-infused puffs. That's not the tissue to use when you're crying. I should have probably specifically said that. So, but there, I mean, if you're blowing your nose, it's fantastic, especially if you have a cold. But don't wipe tears out of your eyes with Vicks-infused puffs, as our listener's wife can attest. So, all right, some more origin stories. How about this one? Wi-Fi was actually made to detect exploding mini black holes. Stephen Hawking predicted that mini black holes released some radio waves when they vanished into space. Dr. John O'Sullivan worked hard to make a device to detect those waves, but he could not find anything. He later took a job with a company trying to make wireless networks where his black hole detection tool fit perfectly. So when you say, hey, do you have free Wi-Fi, you should be saying, hey, do you have free black hole detection tool?
And then they will stare and ask you to please leave the Starbucks.
Could you get out of the Starbucks, please? Hey, you like wearing pajamas? You have World War I air raids to thank for that. Ooh. In World War I, people were being driven out of their homes by nighttime air raids, and they needed warm, practical, and decent-looking sleepwear. So pajamas became hugely popular. They were loose, covered you up, and could be very stylish. Wow. Okay. There you go. World War I air raids. For everybody who's in their PJs right now, I bet a good portion of our listeners are in their PJs right now. Marlboro. Marlboro's very first consumer target was women. There really was women? This is the company that's absolutely known for the Marlboro Man, the big macho cowboy dude. Their campaign ads include a slogan that read, "Beauty tips to keep the paper from your lips." Since the tips were covered with a red band to hide women's lipstick stains. After failing to attract women, the tips were changed to a muted brown and then marketed to men.
Interesting.
Wow, that's fascinating. And they actually, and by the way, if you want to see this this article, complete with like pictures and really cool stuff, it's on our Facebook page. That's why you should like us and follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/NickDShow. I'm looking at the old ad, and it's pretty. It's America's luxury cigarette was the slogan for Marlboro. America's luxury cigarette.
Ooh, wow!
I used to love the old, back in the day when they would have billboards and stuff for smoking, for cigarettes and stuff. And back in the loop there at State Chicago and Chicago and State there, at State and Lake, that whole area, State and Lake, right there, heart of the loop. There used to be a billboard on top of where the Walgreens is now, which is at Randolph and State. And it was the Marlboro Man. And so it was just like, it was the and they had this in Times Square, too. Actually, it probably had it in a bunch of different cities where it was a big billboard advertising Marlboro cigarettes. And so they had it in Times Square, and they also had it right down here in the heart of the loop where all the movie theaters were. And I used to love this thing. It was on, like I said, it was on top of the building where the Walgreens is now. And it was the Marlboro Man, and smoke would actually come out of his mouth. Like they had a hole where his mouth
like,
is, and
like
smoke would come out. Because I think they put, like, they funneled the chimney behind the billboard, and so actual smoke would come out of the guy's would come out of the guy's mouth and
wow.
On the billboard. It was
like
awesome.
He's really smoking.
It was awesome. Awesome. They did that too in Times Square. Same thing. They had the Marlboro guy with the smoke coming out.
Do you remember when they made it illegal to advertise cigarettes, or at least they had to change the way they did it?
It had to be in the 80s.
Yeah.
It had to be in the 80s.
Because when I was growing up, the only cigarette ads I saw were for Newports, because it was the Newport Pleasure.
Yeah.
And
no,
they were really strange. I never knew what they were for, but they were always
ads. There were always the, like, the Virginia Slims. They had the black eye, people with the black eye. There was, I mean, yeah. There were a lot of cigarette ads. And I remember when you couldn't, Now you can't do cigarette, you know, on television commercials either. But they used to sponsor back in the 60s and 50s. You could go back and watch the Game Show Network.
Oh, yeah.
They would give away like cartons. Here you go. Here are two cartons of Chesterfields.
Yeah, it was always Chesterfields.
Sponsored by Chesterfields or sponsored by some sort of like Old Gold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Winston cigarettes.
Absolutely.
The choice of a new generation.
Well, Winston was menthol.
That
was menthol.
Well, you can't go into space if you smoke menthol.
There used to be a time when you could send a kid with a note to buy cigarettes. My parents used to do it.
Back in the good old days.
My parents, in the 70s, we had a little corner grocery store on the corner.
They send you go get smokes?
Absolutely.
Well, you had to be good for something.
I had a note from my mom that said, I give permission for my son to buy two packs of Cool 100s. My mom was a menthol smoker.
There you go.
Cool 100s. My dad was Camel.
He was a Camel man.
Camel man. Yeah. My dad, Camel straights, man. Like no filter. Yeah.
Yeesh.
But that was in the days. In the 70s, everybody smoked.
Yeah.
Babies smoked in the 70s.
I always knew my grandma, for the longest time, I always knew she was around because all I could smell was Marlboro Lights and, what was it, White Diamonds. That was her perfume.
Sure.
Very
White
specific.
Diamonds. It's Elizabeth Taylor. Yeah.
That's how I always knew my grandma was around.
See, again, that's that sense of smell. Here's Donald on WGN. Go ahead, Donald.
Hi, yeah. A lot of times what you were mentioning about how a drug can be used as something else, even though it wasn't originally intended, Prozac, which is fluoxetine hydrochloride, was originally going to be a diet pill. And that's what it was tested for. But they realized there were huge mood shifts on a lot of the people. So it eventually became marketed as an antidepressant.
Oh, there you go. Interesting.
And that's not all. Ketamine, I believe, was originally a tranquilizer to bring down large animals so that they could like work on them. And then now it's being used very effectively for depression.
Right, exactly. All right, thanks, Donald.
Mm-hmm.
All right, take care. How about bendy straws? Bendy straws were popularized in hospitals where they made drinking easier for sick and disabled people. Joseph B. Friedman invented them after seeing his daughter having trouble drinking a milkshake.
Well, now she can drink her milkshake.
I love the... Yeah.
She can drink it right up.
She can drink... I drink your milkshake. I drink it up. I have a straw, and you have a straw. And my straw reaches all the way over here.
I'm not going to lie. That's a remarkably good Daniel
Day-Lewis. Oh, thank you. That's not Daniel Day-Lewis. Well, that's Daniel Plainview.
I mean,
yeah,
that's true.
Yeah. I am an oil man. You're just a bastard in a basket. I've seen that movie a couple times.
Once or twice.
Oh, my God. I have a T-shirt. I haven't busted it out. I do have a T-shirt that says, I drink your milkshake. I drink it up. I love the end of the movie. I'm finished. Beats the hell out of him with a bowling pin. That movie rules. God, I remember the first time I saw it, I lost my mind. Oh, my God. And I know Kevin. Kevin J. O'Connor.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it with him, like he was sitting next to me at one point, one of the times I saw it. And he tells some unbelievable. I'll tell you. I'm not going to tell him on the air. But he told me some pretty unbelievable stories. some pretty unbelievable Joaquin Phoenix stories.
Oh, I can't even.
Oh, man.
I can't even imagine.
Yeah, when he got back from shooting The Master, I was like, "Oh, you got to tell me some stuff." Oh my god! Oh my god! Kevin's great, man. He's awesome. So, all right, let's break here for some weather. Oh, it's going to be, you know what? It's going to be a pleasurable experience to read the weather today.
That's a nice change of pace.
As opposed to last week when it was a nightmare, especially come Wednesday through Friday. It's a pleasure right now to read this forecast to you. Here's your forecast from the WGN Weather Center. Today, temperatures will hover a low to mid-60s early and then breezy, noticeably cooler and less humid. Fair and cool overnights, upper 50s in the outlying suburbs, 60s downtown. open up the windows, everybody.
I should have brought a hoodie or something.
Yeah.
I might get a little...
Yeah, I'm wearing shorts. I just, you know, I just presume that we have to wear shorts for the rest of the year. I mean, even through December.
Now that we live on the sun.
Yeah. Tomorrow, mild temps and comfortable humidity levels for a pleasant summer day. Low 80s inland, 70s near the lake. See, that's the kind of weather forecast you want in July. Not the nonsense that I had to read last week. Wednesday, high pressure settles across the Midwest, bringing ample sun, light winds. Temperatures will reach the mid-80s. Thursday, abundant sunshine boosts the temperatures to the mid-80s and fair and mild overnight. Friday, sunny and warmer with a modest high in raise in humidity. Afternoon peaks will be near 90. Currently, 67 degrees at O'Hare, 69 at Midway, 68 at the lakefront. All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll wrap up the conversation about origins of everyday products and then jump into some TV mistakes. 312-981-7200 is the phone number.
The Indians send signals from the rocks above the pass. The cowboys take position in the bushes and the grass. The score is with the corporal, she is tied against the tree.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. And that's what's coming up. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN. Okay, we've been talking about everyday products that have some pretty interesting, sometimes crazy origin stories. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312 area code says, Virginia Slims, where you've come a long way, baby. Oh, that's right. Tarryton was the black eye. I'd rather fight than switch. Virginia Slims was, again, marketed to women. Virginia Slims was specifically marketed to women. You've come a long way, baby. That's right. The black eye was Tarryton. Remembering all those old cigarette ads. Here's another origin thing here. Coin-operated vending machines have been used since the first century in Greece. The machine was originally invented to prevent people from stealing the holy water. People were stealing holy water? I mean, isn't that a bit... I mean, shouldn't you know that... I mean, if you're going to steal holy water, shouldn't you know that you shouldn't? Yeah. Coin operator. I have to tell my dad this. You know, my dad, in the vending business for well over 55 years, like, used to, build vending machines, like, the big console machines. Used to work at a place called Victor Vending where they would build the machines. My dad had, like, a master key. Like, we could go into the jewels where the vending machines were. My dad could actually unlock it and open it up.
Like, here, take this package of rolled gold.
And no. These were like gumball machines. Where they'd have a plastic capsule with like a little treat in it. You know, like a football helmet, one of the little football helmets, yeah, or something like that. And they would make at where my dad worked, they would make the actual capsules, the plastic. They would roll giant sheets of plastic through a machine. They would press out the thing. My dad used to do that. My dad would build the machines. Then he went into stocking the machines. He would come home with like bags of bubble gum, like gumballs and stuff, because he would fill up gumball machines and stuff. And he's been in the business. My dad still kind of works from home, does sales for a small vending company, you know, still supplying people with vending stuff. So I'm gonna have to tell my dad it all started from people stealing holy water. But yeah, my dad's been in that business forever.
Yeah,
forever. The Chinese takeout box was originally invented for holding raw oysters. It's also an American invention, not Chinese. Okay. That's another thing that we've talked about in the past. Evidently, we're using the Chinese takeout box wrong.
Yeah, it's supposed to be like a little plate.
You fold it out and it turns into a plate. No.
Because where are you
going to keep the leftovers? You keep them in the box. Mm. Scoop it out onto a plate, whatever you're having. Close it. Box goes in the fridge.
Yeah, I'm not going to dirty a Tupperware box.
No, of course not. That's why the box in front of me. Exactly. Nike's raised sneaker treads were invented with a waffle iron. I knew about this one.
Yeah.
Nike co-founder Bill Bowerman realized the pattern left by his waffle iron would make for well-gripping shoe treads. He used the iron to create... the famous Nike prototype moon shoes.
Now, I had a pair of moon boots.
Yeah.
My parents.
Got you moon boots?
Yeah. I think it was my dad's moon boots at one point, because he was into kind of weird stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I used to wear those religiously.
How about this? The earliest pillows were made of stone.
Wow, real.
Yeah.
The predecessor to the MyPillow.
Exactly.
Evidently.
Originally more about keeping the head away from crawling bugs. Oh, that's nice. Or protecting an elaborate hairstyle during sleep than a cushion. They evolved into elaborate works for the art and wealthy. Of art for the wealthy. They only became cloth covered with stuffing after the textile revolution. And there are pictures here of an ancient Egyptian pillow, which is made of stone, an ancient Chinese pillow. And the neck rest from King Tut's tomb. During the 1700s, pineapples were so expensive, they were served only to the most important guests. The fruit would cost $8,000 in today's money. What? I mean, I like pineapple as much as the next guy, but $8,000? Jeez. Did not know that. More origin stories. Nutella was the solution to the cocoa shortage during World War II. Mixing cocoa with hazelnuts and milk created a chocolate spread that lasted longer than cocoa could last on its own. So because there was a shortage of cocoa during World War II, Nutella was born. I had no idea that Nutella was around since World War II. I enjoy Nutella. How about this? Right after the park opened in the mid-50s, the Casa de Fritos restaurant in Disneyland was throwing away a lot of stale tortillas. A salesman for their food supplier noticed a pile of old tortillas in the trash and told them he should try deep-frying them. Taking his advice, he pulled out some of the from the trash can. He fried them. He seasoned them and fried them, and thus Doritos were born. So the first batch of Doritos were taken out of a garbage can. From Disneyland.
And now children everywhere have cheese-encrusted fingers.
Yeah. The $2 microwave. Percy Spencer, the guy who discovered the microwave back in 1945, got paid only $1 or $2 for the patent. Oh, man. Oh, the poor guy. It was the basic reward that the Raytheon company used to give their employed inventors. Guy got $2 for inventing the microwave.
Literally revolutionary.
Or the, what is it, the space oven?
The science oven.
Science oven, right.
Revolutionizing the way that we reheat food.
Yep. The stethoscope was invented by a French doctor named René Lanier because he was embarrassed having to press his ear to women's chests listening to their hearts and lungs. How about that?
I mean, that can be, even as a doctor, that might be a little awkward.
Yeah.
Hold on, I'm going to just gingerly place my ear.
Yeah. In the old days, wasabi was added to sushi not because of its flavor, but because of its antibacterial properties. It was originally used to kill bacteria and parasites in the sushi to avoid digestive problems. Now, with better sanitation and hygiene, it's just eaten for fun.
I don't know if fun is the word I would use to describe wasabi.
Or, in Steve-O's case from Jackass, to snort.
Ugh.
Yeah. He snorts wasabi, but he won't put a toy car in his butt. I just he objects to that. After all the stuff that he did on that show. But you know, hey, do you know that there's another Jackass movie in the making?
You've got to be kidding me.
Not kidding you.
Well, I'm guessing since Johnny Knoxville's kind of side projects didn't exactly pan out too well.
Yeah. So It'll be the masterpiece that everybody's waiting for.
Jackass 4.
Oh, my God.
A New Hope.
I can't even imagine how excited I'm going to be when that thing comes out.
When that Monday morning movie review rolls around, you're going to get ripped apart, man.
It's going to say, you know what? Screw Citizen Kane. Jackass 4 is out. I met Johnny Knoxville and Jeff Tremaine. I interviewed him for Jackass 3D. And I met them, and they couldn't be cooler. They were awesome. It was a great interview. And I told them what actually happened when I went to a movie theater and they showed a trailer for Jackass 3D, and I told them this is a true story. I'm in the theater and the play, I can't remember what movie I was seeing, but they showed the trailer for Jackass 3D and the trailer ended. Some guy screamed out loud, F Avatar! I told Tremaine almost fell off the couch laughing.
Yeah.
All right, finally, artificial Christmas trees are basically big toilet bowl brushes. Addis Housewares Company had been manufacturing toilet brush cleaners for years before they used the same machinery and bristles to produce the first fake evergreens. So next time you're hanging your ornaments on your artificial tree, you know, if you know, you just think about it being scrubbing your toilet.
You ever need a new scrubber, just break off a branch.
Yeah. So, all right. Let's take a break. We got the news coming up here on 720 WGN, and then we are going to talk about some mistakes that actually made to air, some infamous TV show mistakes. That's all coming up. 312-981-7200. News after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and the great Steve Cochran has your morning drive at 6. So there you go. Hey, welcome back. Monday morning, my dad's going to tell a joke because he does that every Monday morning. Going to call in and tell a jokey time. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. If you would like to join us, 312-981-7200. Okay. We all like to enjoy, to watch and enjoy TV. Now, there have been some mistakes that have been made on TV shows in the past. And that's what we're going to be talking about here. And if you want to check out the full article that this is inspired by, it's from ask.com. Not Ask Jeeves, just ask.com. And you can check it out on our Facebook page right now. Like us there. Check it out. Follow us at Facebook.com/Nick D Show, Facebook.com/Nick D Show. When you're making a hit TV show, there are endless details to manage to make sure everything runs smoothly. The slightest adjustment, line change, or camera shift can have unfortunate consequences. One mistake can launch discussion boards and memes of epic proportions as viewers binge over and analyze their favorite TV shows. That's why some flubs from your favorite TV shows stand out as the most infamous mistakes of all time. So what's interesting is that I'm trying to see what the date of this article is, because I want to know if it was written before or after the coffee cup.
At the Game of Thrones panel at San Diego Comic-Con, yeah. They all brought out Starbucks coffee.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, they did. So they're good. They're taking it in stride.
That's funny, man. Boy, that was such a ridiculous big deal. And then wasn't there bottle?
There was a water bottle in the very last episode. Just to add insult to injury.
Yeah. Well, we've got some other ones. How about this one? Friends was the first show of its kind to portray members of Generation X in their 90s glory. The plot was simple. Six people in New York drink coffee, stay indoors, and rip each other's life choices to shreds. Sadly, their slacker mentality may have been shared by the production staff, as Friends has made some major blunders through its 10 seasons. Take their apartments, for instance. In the first season, Joey and Chandler lived in apartment number 4. While Monica and Rachel lived in number 5. Later in the season, the producers realized that their apartments weren't at ground level and upgraded their flat numbers to number 19 and number 20. So there you go. So they without explanation, they went from number 4 and number 5 to number 19 and number 20.
I think one of the big things that I always ask about Friends is, how are they all able to afford these luxurious... Of course, it's a sitcom, but
I mean, that's the biggest thing about it, is that they live in Manhattan.
Yeah.
They can't afford those apartments, not with the jobs that they have.
I don't know what half of them even do for jobs.
Well, Joey was an actor who never got parts, right?
Right, I think.
I don't know. Chandler was in an office. All I know is that it's on here. It's on at 12:30 and 3:30 every morning here in the... I have it on. Channel 9 is on two of the monitors here in the studio. So I see it. I don't hear it.
Yeah.
Chandler was in an office.
Phoebe sings about smelly cats.
I don't know what Phoebe does for a living.
Yeah.
I've seen Jennifer Aniston working in the coffee shop. in certain episodes where she's like waitressing in the coffee shop. No idea what Courtney Cox does.
They're all just giving false hope to a bunch of people trying to move to New York.
Ross was at a museum. Does he work in a museum?
I think he's like an anthropologist or something.
Yeah.
But
anyway, none of those, I don't care what those occupations are, you know, you live that long in Midtown Manhattan and spend all your money on gourmet coffee and Lisa Kudrow on her wardrobe, because she always had the most sort of crazy wardrobe of anybody.
I bet it was rent control or something.
Yeah,
like
I think that was the, you know what, I think I read that somewhere, that was the writer's excuse, was that it was they found two rent control apartments. How about this? A low budget and poor design decisions led to The Walking Dead's most memorable moment. This is from The Walking Dead. The odds were always stacked against the show as devoted fans craved big budget visuals reserved for major network productions. But out of all the cheesy explosions and campy zombie carnage, nothing compares to the janky deer from season 7. An unintentional oversight sensation, the deer became a star for all the wrong reasons. The filmmakers used an actual deer in emotional shots moments before immediately switching it out for the CGI abomination. The intensity of the visual switch in the show, mixed with the embarrassing special effects, left fans, for better or worse, in stitches. Do you know about the deer in Walking Dead? Because by season 7, I was out.
I remember a controversy about it, about the deer.
It was a switch between live and CG. Yeah. That was the big thing.
That was, yeah.
But I never saw it. Mm-hmm. I was done by season 3.
I remember people talking about it, but I think I had more or less checked out at that point, watching so infrequently that I didn't care.
I went back and watched the season premiere of Negan? Is that the character Negan?
That Jeffrey.
Yeah. Baseball bat, barbed wire, that guy.
Yeah. No, all right. That's him.
There was all the buzz surrounding, oh man, this character is going to be great. And you got to watch the first episode of the new season. That's where they're all on their knees. Mm-hmm. And he goes around. He's got the baseball bat. And I was like, okay, I'll go back. I've heard so much about it. I watched 45 minutes of it. I didn't make it through the whole hour. And I was like, this is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's when they killed off Steven Yeun. They kill a whole bunch of the characters. It was just ridiculous.
Well, the comic book series is based on is now over.
Right.
So they're in the end game,
right,
so to speak.
How about this? Not every blooper is cause for outrage from diehard fans. Sometimes a blooper can even help a show be funnier than intended. On Seinfeld's parking lot episode, that's where they forgot where they parked the car, and the entire episode is them trying to find the car.
Classic.
The foursome is on the hunt for their missing car. After a series of freakouts and poor choices, the gang finally finds the car. When they try to start it, the car stalls out, but that wasn't in the script. Really? The kicker is that everyone on set agreed it was a better ending for the car to stall after all that effort. You can even spot the foursome laughing as Kramer continues to rev the engine. That's pretty funny. I mean, that's a great capper.
That's the spirit of Seinfeld right there.
Yeah.
They spend all this time, and when they finally succeed, they still fail.
So funny. All right, how about this? On Sex and the City, Carrie Bradshaw wore a lot of shoes and dated a lot of men in New York City. The shoes were always expensive, unique, and rarely worn twice, but some of the men were quite similar to each other, so similar, in fact, that they were the exact same person. In season 1, Bradshaw dates Jared, an up-and-coming writer played by Justin Theroux. In season 2, Bradshaw dates another writer, Vaughn, also played by Justin Theroux. Theroux wore glasses, shaved his head, and dealt with different intimacy issues on screen as Vaughn. Neither suit survived more than one episode, but their confusing legacy continues to perplex diehard fans. So Justin Theroux played two different boyfriends of Carrie's. Did not know that, because I don't care about Sex and the City, so that's clearly why I didn't know it. All right, how about this one? Producing a show with a large cast of secondary characters can be difficult. But when you're trying to bring a character back to an episode, you have to make sure that the actor is available. Otherwise, it'd be pretty obvious that it was a different actor cast for someone else's role. Unfortunately for the makers of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, this rule also applies to animals, especially if they're as cute and cuddly as Captain Holt's dog, Cheddar. Viewers spotted the different Pembroke Welsh corgis cast as Cheddar because some Cheddars had orange spots while other Cheddars had brown spots. And why they kept switching dogs, the case remains unsolved. You know, I've seen every episode of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and I did not know. Did you notice a different Cheddar?
No. I know one Cheddar passed away recently.
Oh, is that what happened?
Yeah, one of the Cheddars that appeared the most, one of those corgis, died like maybe a couple weeks ago.
That's probably why. It died that recently?
Yeah, very recently.
Oh,
I don't know.
Cheddar.
Poor little Cheddar.
Oh. All right. All right. Well, we got a break here. We've got some weather here. We'll take a break. We'll come back, and we're going to jump back into infamous mistakes that were made on TV shows. And if you would like to join us, talk or text, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Yeah. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's a Monday morning, and that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because we hear a joke from my dad every Monday morning. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. We're talking about some infamous mistakes that were made on TV shows. And by the way, I do want to mention a couple of celebrity birthdays today. Willem Dafoe's birthday today.
Willem Dafoe,
64 years old today. And the great John Leguizamo. How old do you think John Leguizamo is?
He looks ageless, really.
I know.
He's aged so little. I'm going to say like 56.
55.
Wow.
Nice job.
Cool.
Star of one of my favorite underseen movies of all time, Hanging with the Homeboys.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite movies. Great movie. Terrible title.
I thought he was really good in Ice Age.
I think he's great. I love him. I think he's great in everything.
He's got a fun role. He's got a fun recurring role in the John Wick movies, although he wasn't in 3.
He wasn't in 3.
No. I wish he would have been. Nice to see him.
He's been great in a ridiculous amount of movies. Summer of Sam, he's unbelievable in Summer of Sam. Unbelievable. But anyway, happy birthday to those guys. We're talking about mistakes made on television shows. 312-981-7200. Here's John on WGN. Go ahead, John.
Oh, hi. All right. First of all, my mom loves you. She listens to you every night.
I appreciate that.
The mistake is on MASH, the greatest show of all time, in my opinion. Radar smoked cigars. All smooth season on MASH. But then in season 5 or 6,
We're losing John. Sorry, John. So there was a problem with Radar and his cigars with MASH.
Yeah, he said that. Sorry about the connection, John, but he said that Radar smokes cigars through most of the series, but then in one episode, he gets offered a cigar and they keep playing it off as a bit that he doesn't know how to smoke a cigar.
Oh.
So it's kind of inconsistent because, of course, you would know how to smoke a cigar.
Because he smokes cigars all the time. Okay. I do not remember that detail at all. All right. How about this? It seems that the lovable group of misfit boys on Stranger Things who can't seem to escape supernatural terrors may have also managed to time travel. If they haven't, then what's the explanation for the walkie-talkies they used throughout the first season? During season one, oh, man, this is really nitpicking right here. During season one, the boys use TRC-214 walkie-talkies to check in from bedroom to bedroom or bedroom to the upside-down hellscape. But those very expensive walkie-talkies weren't available to buy until 1985, and the first season takes place in 1983. Let's assume the upside-down had a futuristic Radio Shack just down the street. That's a being it. Isn't that being a little nitpicky, don't you think?
I guess so. It's one of those things where it's accurate, but...
Yeah. Hey, wait a minute. That's a TRC-214. Like, if you're... You know what I mean? If you're watching Stranger Things and you're like, hey, this show sucks. That's a TRC-214.
Oh, wow.
All right. Let's see. On That 70s Show, fans relive the most awkward teenage moments through the cast's hilarious storylines. Foreman, Jackie, Kelso, Hyde, Donna, and Fez laughed, cried, and smoked their way throughout high school in Wisconsin. But exactly how long were they in high school for anyway? The show lasted 8 years from 98 to 06, but the cast stayed in high school throughout its entire run. It's especially strange since the teenagers were sophomores and juniors in the first season. So does that mean they were in high school until their 20s? Fans never got an explanation for the wonky timeline. And the cast's facial hair and crow's feet inexplicably paired with graduation caps and gowns. I guess I forgive that.
Yeah, I don't think they realized how successful that show was going to be.
Yeah.
Because
well, I mean, listen, the Simpsons are still the same age. They've been on for 30 years.
Yeah, that's true. Sometimes you just got to forgive it.
Yeah. You know, Bart and Lisa are still in the same, they're still in the same grade, I would imagine. So, a celebration was in order when Dunder Mifflin launched its very own website. Of course, because this is The Office, a simple office party turned into a series of competitive hijinks to determine who could plan the best party. Spoiler alert, it wasn't Michael, who failed to order a decent pizza, kidnapped the delivery boy, and had a series of emotional outbursts. But the biggest blunder of the episode doesn't come out of Michael's mouth. It actually comes from Jim's pen. When signing Meredith's cast, Jim signs the name John Krasinski? Whoa, now I gotta go back and watch that episode for sure.
That's funny.
Production needed to two full episodes to complete the main story, but Krasinski's blunder remains the most memorable part of the party. So it's a two-part episode of the holiday of planning the oh my god, he signs John Krasinski. By the way, there's a picture of it here.
Is it very obvious?
It says John Krasinski, yes. That is hilarious.
Oh,
Speaking of questionable timelines, in season 7 of Will and Grace, Will battles an identity crisis ahead of his 37th birthday. We know Will going through identity crisis is as routine as Karen entering a room and immediately insulting Grace's wardrobe. Particular problem that raised eyebrows because of the entirety of season 8, we see Will complaining about being 41. How did 4 years pass in such little to no change in the characters' lives? Was this an oversight in the writer's room, or did Jack convince Will he was older than he actually was? I wouldn't have known that ever.
Mm-hmm.
Another friend blunder. Ready for another friend blunder?
Love a good friend blunder.
It occurs during Rachel's 30th birthday episode. The gang gathers by the cake to usher Rachel into her third decade, only she gets cold feet over aging. Join the club. To calm their grieving friend, Phoebe, Ross, Monica, Chandler, and Joey all share their 30th birthday stories. But Joey shouldn't be sharing his 30th birthday story. In the first season of the show, Joey says he's 25, while Rachel and Monica are 26. Rachel later reveals to a cop in season 7 that she's an Aquarius, but her birthday's in May. Sounds like Rachel should have taken a friendly glance at her birth certificate for clarity's sake. Okay. All right. Let's see. How about this? Character age continuity issues aren't just problematic on TV shows with living actors. On Family Guy, a similar continuity error counters balances an entire plot of an episode. In Underage Peter, Griffin and his friends go out on a typical late-night booze bender, only this time the town suffers major damage. In retaliation, Mayor Adam West raises the town's drinking age to 50, prohibiting almost all of Griffin's friends from buying booze. The gang realizes Brian the dog is able to buy booze in dog years. But what about Quagmire? The running gag throughout the series is that Quagmire is 60 and looks good for his age, but this fact is completely ignored in that episode. Quagmire is 60?
Yeah.
Okay. Giggity giggity.
I've got one that I remember off the top of my head.
Okay.
And this happens a lot, is when you have characters in Law and Order playing characters.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The one I always remember is actor Kelly Giddish, who plays Detective Rollins, appears in SVU as both a victim and then as a detective later on in the series.
I think that's happened before.
Yeah.
I really think that that's happened before, because the amount of actors that who have appeared multiple times on all the different Law and Orders is just crazy. I'm sure that that's happened.
But I think it's the only time that someone was like just one of the victims or something like that.
Or one of the suspects.
Yeah, one of the suspects, and then turns into a series regular. Yeah. It was so weird because I remembered her. I was like, well, wait, she was in a previous episode. But
I think that's probably happened. Maybe not as a series regular, but I'm sure there have been repeat multiple characters played by same actors on crossover on those shows.
Yeah, because everybody's been in
Everybody, Law and Order. Every New York actor has at some point been in Law and Order.
Kyle McLaughlin appeared twice as two different people.
On Breaking Bad, how about this? Pizza is a topic that can raise a lot of eyebrows. Yes, the show is actually about a chemistry teacher that produces meth to make some extra cash, but Walter White's legend status wasn't cemented in his extracurricular activities. It soon became, and as soon as he perfectly launched an entire pizza onto his foot in a fit of onto his roof in a fit of rage. In one brilliant take, actor Bryan Cranston was able to launch the pizza onto White's roof. But fans noticed that the pizza parlor forgot to cut the pizza into slices, leaving the pie in its original form. Later in the episode, the mysterious pizza moves around the roof to a scene from scene to scene and somehow develops pepperoni toppings with no chemical equation to make any sense of it. All right. Well, let's do this. Let's take a break here. We got the news coming up right here on 720 WGN. And then after that, we got more infamous mistakes made on TV shows. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. And just a little while, my dad's going to call in and tell a joke right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning. That means in just a few minutes, my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And Steve Grzanich is coming up at 5 with the opening bell. The great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. We are talking about some of the infamous mistakes that were made on TV shows, and we can go back and see them. We got some texts. If you want to call or text us on any of this stuff, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. 708 area code. It's Jim from Crestwood says, the calendar in Floyd's barbershop on Andy Griffith's show is always on February. Wow. All right. Next time you watch Andy Griffith, keep your eyes peeled. If they're in Floyd's barbershop, the calendar is always on February. That's pretty funny. 765 area code says, on Little House on the Prairie, several characters eat peanut butter sandwiches in various episodes. The series takes place in the 1870s and 1880s, and peanut butter wasn't invented until early 1900s. Look at that. Look at the sharp eye on that viewer.
I learned something relatively new regarding those Little House.
Yeah.
Like, apparently my girlfriend, who I've, you know, been with for 7 years now.
Because we were talking about Little House, you were like, what the hell is that?
Yeah. Apparently, she was a huge fan of those books when she was a child, to the point where for like a dress-up day for school, I think it was for Halloween, she went to school as Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Sure. Laura was a popular character, man. No, it was a big deal. It was a big deal. You missed it out. You missed the whole deal.
I guess so.
Like, culturally, it was huge. Little House on the Prairie was huge, both in book form and on TV.
I was too busy watching Benny Hill.
Yeah. Fans are hungry for bloopers on their favorite shows whenever they can find them, even in promo photos. Take Game of Thrones, for instance. The internet called foul play when an image of Jaime Lannister hugging his sister with both hands appeared. While the image does not appear to show his right hand, it was only a promo photo that was used by HBO that slipped through the editor's cracks. So while this does constitute a blooper, it's one that viewers won't spot on the show. So it didn't appear on the show, but it did appear. But it did appear in a promo show. So this, when did Jaime Lannister? He had one hand. What happened?
Yeah, he gets his hand chopped off.
All right,
at one point.
Okay, so in a promo shot, he actually has two hands at one point. All right, how about this? Another mistake on Friends. This one is out of this world. Seriously, when the show completely dismisses the existence of time zones, it must take place in an alternate universe. Back in season 3, Monica gets a very generous tip from a wealthy customer who later asks her on a dinner date. Which one is Monica?
That's Courtney Cox.
Courtney Cox, all right. I should have known that because I know Phoebe.
Yeah.
And I know
Rachel.
Rachel, yeah. The other one's got to be Monica. Assuming their first date will be somewhere in the Manhattan area, Monica leaves with her purse and a smile. The show immediately cuts to Rome, where they're in the same clothes and are enjoying dinner at a restaurant. But Rome is 6 hours ahead of New York. Dinner time would have been long past. Also, did her date ask her to bring along her passport for this casual date? All right. Boy, they're really nailing friends in this article.
Yeah. It's clearly they were not paying attention.
Clearly. On The Big Bang Theory, one of the longest running gags was that their building had a broken elevator. Oh, really?
Wow.
I hate that show, even though I've only seen like one episode of it. I've tried a few times. It's just not funny. It's not a funny show. There were even attempts courtesy of an acquired time machine to fix the clunky lift. With each attempt to fix the elevator, the timeline gets more convoluted. In season one, Leonard says the elevator was broken 2 years ago. Later in season three, Leonard's failed attempt to fix it happened 7 years ago. Even later in the show, Howard makes an attempt to fix it on his own, but gives up. But if he was present when Leonard blew it up indecipherable years ago, why was he trying to use basic tools to fix it? The science just does not add up on the broken elevator. During the opening credits of Sex and the City, a colorful Carrie Bradshaw makes her way down a busy New York City block. As she struts down the street in her tutu, a crowded bus with an ad for her column drives through a puddle, soaking Carrie. Things get confusing after the bus soaks Carrie and she gasps in disgust at her bad luck. Right behind her, as the bus drives away, we see a completely empty bus. Fans couldn't help but wonder, did everyone on the bus find their stop and immediately jump out? Were they so appalled by her outfit that they disintegrated into disgust? In disgust?
I'm going to put my money on the latter.
How about this? Another friend's mistake. The storyline isn't the only thing that can cause mistakes on the show. Sometimes a camera angle can catch more than the viewers have expected. Take this casual friend scene in Central Perk with Phoebe and Monica. In an instant, the camera cuts from Phoebe to Monica to Phoebe, and then Phoebe and Monica stand-in. TV shows are often use stand-ins while cameras focus on actors within a shot. But zooming out too much can spell disaster. So, for people who might not know, there are times when they shoot close-ups when the other actor who is having the conversation is not there, and they just have somebody stand in for lighting purposes and stuff like that. So that happens. It happens all the time. Happens in movies. Happens on TV. Happens all the time. And some people, there are a lot of actors in the business who find it frustrating that stand-ins come in, and always appreciate it when an actor will be there for close-ups. Like when the actor that you're talking to, a lot of actors are like, I will be there, don't worry about it, I won't use a stand-in. So that you can actually make eye contact with the person that you're actually acting with.
Right.
Instead of just some dude standing there.
Mm-hmm.
So they do this all the time. So it happened on Friends. Several shots throughout the series reveal boom mics. Of course, you see that. Boom mics, exterior lights, and other set pieces that don't fit in a Greenwich Village apartment. So, yeah, you see a boom mic every once in a while. I remember when I went to go see, this is very specific memory, but I went to go see Neil Simon's Seems Like Old Times, which is one of my favorite movies. It's Chevy Chase, Goldie. Have you seen Seems Like Old Times?
I haven't seen it, but I know of it.
It's fantastic. Yeah. It's brilliant. It's so fun. It's much better than Foul Play, which was the first movie that Goldie Hawn and Chevy Chase made together. It's much better. It's really funny. And I also happen to enjoy movies a little bit more when a character is named Nick. And I always like that. And Chevy Chase's name is Nick mm-hmm. in the movie. So it's Chevy Chase, Goldie Hawn, Charles Grodin. One of my favorite Neil Simon, I think one of the T.K. Carter from The Thing mm-hmm. Is in it. He's hilarious. And when I saw the movie at the Portage Theater when it first came out back in December of 1980, during the courtroom scene, there's a big climactic courtroom scene where all hell breaks loose, and the camera pulls back, and all of a sudden the boom mic at the top of the screen, you can see the boom mic come down. Now, but here's the problem, though. That happens a lot. The problem was, because the Portage was such a terrible theater in the early 80s, it was framed wrong. As you know, in film,
yeah, you have to frame it.
They had it framed too low. Which is why you could see the boom come in, because you can't see it. I've got the thing on DVD. I've got And every time, I saw it in the theater a couple more times, and it never happened. But the very first time I saw the movie, I was like, look at the boom mic. But it was the projectionist's fault. And back in those days, the projectionists had a mighty union, a mighty, mighty union, and they made like $39-40 an hour.
Well, I mean, it's a hard job.
Yeah.
But now I used to literally press play on a computer.
No, that's all it is. The kids who sling popcorn go up there and hit a button, and that's it. But they used to have
the man who slung popcorn,
yeah.
Sir.
Well, not the theater that I go to. They're kids. Yeah. I regularly go to that theater in Skokie, and there's nobody over 18 working in that place.
Nah, man, it's the blind leading the blind.
Yeah. Here's Bob on WGN. Hey, Bob.
Yeah. Morning, Nick. Morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
One of my favorite mistakes was on MASH. Radar is in his bunk pretending to sleep, and he's got a comic book on his chest, and it's clearly marked The Avengers, and this is 1951 to 53 during the Korean War,
right.
And the Avengers didn't come out until the late 60s.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true. That's funny. And also, I mean, one of the things that everybody brings up about MASH is that it lasted 7 years longer than the actual war.
Yep.
So that's something that everybody brings up, too, but that's pretty cool. All right, Bob, thanks.
You're welcome.
Take care. I'm trying to remember. I can't remember the name. My friend, hey, listen, my buddy Joe, my late buddy Joe. Hey, what the hell happened after that first album? We went to go see Desperately Seeking Susan. He and I went to, at the Portage, by the way. That's weird. So we went to the Portage. We saw Desperately Seeking Susan, which is a movie that I really, of course, that I really, really like and is at the sort of the height of the first break of Madonna. Like that was like the, you know, with the little half shirts, the bra, the bracelets, the whole thing.
Yeah.
The whole like mid-80s
Material Girl.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I love Desperately Seeking Susan. I think it's a great movie, but there's a bad guy in Desperately Seeking Susan who I believe is played by Will Patton, if I'm not mistaken, because I haven't seen Desperately Seeking Susan in a while. But he's at one point he's like following her and he's got a comic book. And he was like reading this comic book and he kind of lowers it. So they have the shot of him reading the comic book and he lowers it so you can see his eyes as he's looking at Patricia Arquette. And he looks at it and he raises it back up when she turns. And he's reading this comic book and the comic book is Ambush Bug. And so we thought it was made up. It's like Joe and I, that's hilarious because we were looking at the cover and the cover is really funny. And so we were like, that's hilarious. Ambush Bug. That's pretty funny. It's real. Like Ambush Bug is a real comic book character. I had no idea. So Joe and I actually started reading Ambush Bug. It was like one of the, because I don't read comics, but it was one of the only comics I got into, and that was because of Desperately Seeking Susan. We thought the name of it was funny, and we thought the cover was funny.
Ambush Bug.
Ambush Bug. Real thing. Real comic book character. I don't know if it's still around. I don't know if they still write books. I don't know if it's a real deal. But we thought it was made up. We thought it was specifically made up for the movie. Like this weirdo guy would be reading some comic book called Ambush Bug. But in fact, it's the real deal. And so we started back in like 86 or 85, whenever the hell that movie came out, we started reading Ambush Bug. And it was actually a very funny title. So anyway. All right, let's take a quick break. And my dad is going to call in and tell a joke after we take a break here. We've got some weather for you, my dad's joke, and then we'll wrap up the show and some more infamous mistakes made on TV shows. 312-981-7200. Here's your forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center. Today, temperatures will hover in the low to mid-60s early. Breezy, noticeably cooler, less humid. Fair and cooler overnight. Lows in the upper 50s in the outlying suburbs to the mid-60s downtown. Get those windows open, folks. Air out that place. Well, I should just say, just me. I should air out my apartment. I should just shut up and open up all my windows to air out the humidity that was accumulated over the weekend. For tomorrow, mild temperatures, comfortable humidity levels make it a very pleasant summer day. Highs in the low 80s, inland 70s near the lake. For Wednesday, high pressure settles in across the Midwest, bringing ample sun and light winds, and we'll reach maybe the mid 80s on Wednesday. For Thursday, abundant sunshine boosts temperatures to the mid 80s. It'll be fair and mild overnight. On Friday, it'll be a little bit warmer, but not that much humidity. Afternoon peaks could be near 90. It's currently 67 degrees at O'Hare, at 69 at Midway, 68 at the lakefront. All right, let's take a quick break. We come back, my dad will tell a joke right here on 720 WGN.
Chicago stories told 24/7. 720 WGN. Hi, it's Wendy Snyder. My family and I have been taking Natron's Healthy Trinity for many years now. You've heard me talk about it. Well, we take it every day, researching, formulating, and manufacturing the world's best probiotics. It's all they do. Listen to what Dr. Chris D'Adamo, the Director of Research at the Center for Integrative Medicine at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, has to say.
If you experience gas, bloating, indigestion, loose stool, or constipation, this is not something that you just have to deal with. But I was actually introduced to Natron probiotics for my own personal use. I had been suffering from persistent indigestion, and nothing I had tried had really helped me until I tried Natron probiotics. Natron probiotics provide sustained relief and greatly improved my quality of life to this day, just as they have for countless people across the world. I'm a real believer in the power of Natron probiotics, and as a result, I recommend them to literally everybody. If your probiotic doesn't say Natron on the label, you'll never feel the Natron difference.
Feel the Natron difference for yourself. Go to Natron.com or the probiotic cooler section at Whole Foods or Fruitful Yields or your favorite health food store.
The Wexler Real Estate Group is proud to announce a new initiative, Realtors Who Rescue. They've partnered with NAWS, the National Humane Society of Illinois, a no-kill animal welfare organization that helps partner adoptable pets with animal lovers. With their Realtors Who Rescue program, every person who buys or sells a home with the Wexler Group will have the option at no cost to welcome a rescue dog to their home, or the Wexler Group make a donation to NAWS in your name. For over 35 years, Ron Wexler, Tammy Northcutt, and their entire team have been committed to enhancing the real estate experience of their buyers and sellers, and have also been dedicated to building a deeper connection and trust with every client they serve. With Realtors Who Rescue at the Wexler Group, you can be assured you've hired a realtor who cares about you and your family. Call or text the Wexler Group Realtors Who Rescue hotline at Keller Williams Preferred Realty right now. 708-629-5151. That's 708-629-5151. Or online at thewexlergroup.com.
It's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go. With your music intro. Ah!
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Hey! What'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Yeah. Monday morning. At this time, every week on a Monday morning, my dad tells a joke. We want to get your work week off started with a laugh. So we get my dad in here to tell a joke. And let's do that right now. Here's my dad. Hey, Dad.
Hey, Nick.
How are you, buddy?
I'm doing good.
Good. How's Mom?
She's doing great.
Good. All right, man. You got a joke.
Got a joke.
All right.
To the guy who stole my anti-depression medicine, I hope you're happy now.
All right, all right, all right, all right.
That's very good, Dad. Thank you, buddy.
All right, Nick.
See you
thank
later.
You.
There you go.
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
He'll do. We'll do it again next week.
I hope you're happy.
I hope you're happy now. All right, coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, let's wrap it up here with more TV mistakes. Let's see. Do they have medical experts on call over at Grey's Anatomy? There are so many medical inaccuracies that this program is hard to believe that it's actually a show about doctors. One major blunder happens when Meredith nearly drowns while helping a patient and gets knocked into a body of water by accident. Derek miraculously saves Meredith by performing the worst CPR ever done by a fake doctor on television. Derek gives her one breath and five slow compressions, but he should have given her two breaths and 30 compressions at a faster pace.
Yeah, they tell you you got to do it to staying alive.
Yeah. How about this? On the X-Files, Fox Mulder is a brooding FBI detective who investigated a paranormal activity and phenomena. All that brooding and crime solving left little time for him to date, let alone marry, making him a chronically mysterious and single detective. Yet, in a flashback episode, we see him in his apartment wearing a wedding ring with no explanation. Was there a secret wedding that the show's producers forgot to mention? Was his bachelor pad ever occupied by someone else? It turns out David Duchovny had recently married and wanted to keep his ring on during the filming.
Come on.
Come on, man.
Get into character.
So there you go. You know, by the way, that's a really fun, that's a really another fun sort of thing to notice about Inception. Because when you're watching Inception, you can tell whether it's actually a dream by whether or not DiCaprio's got his wedding ring on.
Oh.
So watch for it, because if he doesn't have his wedding ring on, it is a dream. And if he doesn't, or vice versa, one of the two. No, he's got to have it on, because at the end of the movie it's a dream if he's got it on. It's not a dream. It's real if he doesn't.
Okay.
Or vice versa.
So
if you ever get confused when you're watching Inception, and that is an easy thing to do.
Probably going to happen, yeah.
Even I've seen the movie like 800 times. It's, yeah. I love that movie. And but yeah, that's another
that's
little detail. Yeah.
So in that last scene when he spins the top.
Yeah.
Is he dreaming or?
In my opinion?
Yeah, in your opinion.
No, he's awake. It's real.
Yeah, because
it's real. Because it's real because
the top falls over.
Well, it doesn't fall over.
You don't see it fall over, but it wobbles.
Right before the black, when it cuts to black, it wobbles just a little bit. Just a little bit. It wobbles.
Yeah.
And that's enough. But also, he can see his kids' faces. For every time that he goes back and remembers his kids,
uh-huh.
They're outside on the beach and they're playing and he never sees their face. In the final scene when Michael Caine brings them in,
yeah.
The kids turn around and he sees them. Then he does the totem,
mm-hmm.
Spins it, and then right at the very end it wobbles just a little bit, cut to black, perfect ending.
Yeah. No, because so many people were like, oh, it's so ambiguous. I'm like, not really, because any other time when he's in a dream, it spins uninterrupted.
Yeah.
So yeah. If it's interrupted that means it's
exactly,
because it spins
so much it doesn't move. Like, it's barely moving. It's spinning. There's no wobbling, nothing. It is completely straight. And at the very end of the movie, it wobbles just slightly, and then Nolan cuts to black. I remember the first time I saw it, there were people in the audience like, oh, man! And I was like, no, that's cool. I love that movie. One of the other observations that I made about that I make about that movie when I watch, and I watch it a lot, I really, really love that movie, is that it really... really takes an extraordinarily long time for that van to hit the damn water.
Oh yeah.
that van is in midair going down. Literally like an hour of the movie is that.
But it makes sense because he times it out just right.
It's
you
great.
Know,
it's great. And I really think people don't appreciate DiCaprio's performance in that movie, because DiCaprio was fantastic in that movie.
That was great. That's what got me really like DiCaprio.
When Marianne Cotard jumps off the building, that's some of the most intense acting that DiCaprio's ever done. Oh, God, I love that movie. I just love it. All right, how about this? One of Mad Men's greatest achievements was astute attention to detail throughout the series. Historical authenticity was a major concern to the showrunner, so characters, sets, and plots... had to expertly represent life in the 60s. Unfortunately, for Christina Hendricks, sometimes history can get a tad complicated. When Hendricks' character Joan Harris makes a reservation at the legendary New York City restaurant Le Cirque, she's a bit ahead of her time. The restaurant didn't open until 1974, but the show was set in 1968. Okay.
Good old Christina Hendricks.
Oh, I love her. She's married to that doofus who's in the back seat during... Super Troopers, man.
Yeah.
That idiot.
These snozzberries taste like snozzberries.
Oh, God, that guy. Early in Parks and Recreation, we'll close on this one because Parks and Rec's one of my favorite shows ever. We meet Jerry, the clumsy yet lovable Pawnee office from The Office. He, by the way, I've had him in studio. He's fantastic. He's a great dude. He confesses that his name is actually Gary, but hasn't corrected anyone ever since the senior staffer started calling him Jerry. This is a perfect representation of Jerry, a forgettable character that doesn't want to ruffle feathers around the office. I love the fact that he's got an insanely hot wife. I love that character. It's such a great character. Later in the show, it's revealed his name is actually Gerald, which can go by Jerry for short. Lovable oaf? Sure. Lovable liar? No way. Jerry Gary was never had that real name, so either the writer's got his name wrong or Jerry doesn't remember his own name. Either way, the situation is unbelievable. So we close on that note. All right, we got a break here. The news is coming up next, and we've got some members of the Great Moments in Vinyl coming in tomorrow, one of whom was at Woodstock, like there. Richard Pettengill, we've had him on many times, but we're going to talk about Woodstock. They've got a Woodstock-themed performance coming up as well, and 2 for Tuesday.